You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, we discuss the United States' provision of weapons to dictatorships. We are joined by Rich Whitney, who is an attorney from Carbondale, Illinois, now working as an appellate public defender. He is one of the founding members of the Illinois Green Party, currently serves on its executive committee, and in 2006 served as that party's first ever candidate for governor, winning over 360,000 votes, about 10.5% of the total. He's currently serving as interim co-chair of the Green Party Peace Action Committee. He is also a commentator, satirist, and disc jockey at Community Radio for Southern Illinois, WDBX 91.1 FM, and occasional actor with the stage company in Carbondale. But we have invited Rich on because he's published an article at truthout.org, along with other places, titled U.S. Provides Military Assistance to 73% of World's Dictatorships. Rich Whitney, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Seems to be a topic that everybody paid full time to follow such things has not been reporting on.
Exactly. I mean, the alternative media has been pretty good at picking up on this, but gee, what a shock. The mainstream or corporate media doesn't seem to be getting the message just yet.
No. So what are the facts? How many countries are we talking about? What makes them be dictatorships, et cetera?
Sure. Well, what I did was I wanted to kind of explore this because, you know, we're often the American people are repeatedly told, you know, the dominant narrative is that, well, we have to go to war against Syria because Bashar al-Assad is an evil dictator, or, you know, Kim Jong-un is an evil dictator, so we might have to go to war against him, and so on and so forth. And the kind of unspoken assumption behind this is that, well, the United States, of course, we're on the side of democracy, and sometimes it is spoken, but it's usually just assumed. And, you know, this bothered me because this is one of the main propaganda selling points for our government committing illegal acts of war repeatedly. And so I wanted to challenge this. And when I looked at the question, what I found was that there was a lot of anecdotal stuff. You know, for example, many Americans know that the United States gives major support to Saudi Arabia, you know, the head-chopping capital of the world and extremely misogynistic government and so on. But, you know, they might be sold well, but that's an exception because they're an important ally in the Middle East and so on and so forth. So I wanted to look at something more comprehensive. Exactly how many of the world's dictatorships is our government supporting, you know, with military assistance? And I was mildly surprised that I couldn't really find an answer. Nobody seemed to be doing that work. So I set out to do that work myself. What I did was I first looked, well, what are the world's dictatorships? And even that was kind of a challenge. Nobody seemed to have an ongoing comprehensive list. And I looked at things like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and so on and didn't quite come up with a satisfactory answer. So what I settled on was the this annual report on political rights around the world that is put out by an outfit called Freedom House that at least does kind of a comprehensive global survey of political rights and civil liberties. They call it the Freedom in the World Report. And so I started with that, and then looking at their methodology, I decided that basically there were about 49 countries in the world that could reasonably be defined as a dictatorship. And I used that by basing it on their political rights score, basically a low political rights score, more or less equated to the definition of a dictatorship, which I define, I think, like most people, that a dictatorship means a form of government in which one person or maybe a military junta is making all the major political decisions and leaving the population with no means of changing things other than by either another coup or a revolution. So that was kind of my operating procedure and methodology there. And so I generated this list of 49 nation states that could be fairly categorized as dictatorships. Well, then to complete the work, I had to look at, well, how many of those dictatorships is the United States supporting? And I didn't count economic aid, even though you could make an argument for that. And I didn't count things like, you know, drug interdiction efforts and so on and so forth, even though sometimes those cloak military aid. I just looked at what countries are receiving military training, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers, and what countries are receiving actual military armaments, or at least had an agreement for the sale of armaments. And I used some State Department and Department of Defense sources that aren't easy to find, but I was, you know, you can find them if you dig hard enough. And then I just integrated the two sets of data, and I found that of the 49 dictatorships around the world today, the United States currently either gives military training or is selling arms to 36 of them as of fiscal year 2015, which is the last year for which I had complete data. So, yeah, that's 73% of the world's dictatorships we're currently supporting, you know, and we're paying for it. We, the people, are paying for it. I mean, it's absurd, especially when you consider, you know, wasn't this country supposed to be founded on the premise that, you know, we opposed a monarchy? Well, now we're supporting monarchies and we're supporting dictatorships all around the world. We are not championing democracy, in fact. And I think this is an important fact that the American people need to know about.
I think you are exactly right. Let me make sure that I've got the facts clear. Looking at your list of countries, and I'll link to the Truth Out article from TalkNationRadio.org. It looks like 36 out of the 49 get training from the U.S. military. So that's U.S. tax dollars. And then it looks like 30 out of the 49 buy weapons from U.S. weapons companies, which at least requires that the U.S. government not forbid that happening. But in some cases, we know, in the case of Egypt, for example, that a lot of those weapons are, you know, dollars given by the U.S. government to that country. But in most cases, they're not, right? In most cases, this is not free weapons. This is countries buying weapons.
Right. There's foreign military assistance and there's foreign military sales. And sometimes there's both. I mean, in fact, a lot of the training that some of these countries receive is training on how to utilize the weapons that are then sold or that have been sold. So there is kind of a correlation there.
Which helps sell more weapons, yes, indeed. And we have a State Department in Washington that's going around the world pushing countries to buy more weapons. So there's a marketing firm paid for. But just to be clear, the weapons in most cases are money going to U.S. weapons companies from foreign governments.
Exactly, and sometimes depending on the country, with some U.S. assistance, but it's still support because our government still has to authorize the sale, and if our State Department is authorizing these sales, that's still government action in support of a military dictatorship, and I think that's really the salient point here, is that one way or another, We're supporting helping these dictatorships stay in power.
And I think it's worth noting some countries that the U.S. government does give for free lots of weapons with which to commit horrendous crimes, such as Israel, are not on the list. Presumably, this was not a list of dictatorships written by Palestinians, but by a U.S. think tank, right?
Exactly. You know, Freedom House, and I make this point in the article, Freedom House has, I think, something of a pro-U.S. bias. You know, and you could say the same thing, I think, about Human Rights Watch and some other organizations. But for the purpose of this, I thought that was actually a plus because, if even Freedom House says such and such a country with which the United States is supporting is a dictatorship, well, then you know it's a dictatorship. I mean, because they would have every incentive to try to not categorize it that way.
Indeed. I think that was a wise choice. Rich Whitney, they also have Afghanistan on the list after, well over a decade of liberation. So there is some accuracy there. But I'm not sure everyone in the world would put Iran and maybe not even Russia or Cuba on the list. I mean, the list of countries that the U.S. is not giving military aid to that are on the list seems to be largely the list of designated enemies, of countries not cooperating with the United States.
Exactly. And there's that pro-U.S. bias. And, you can get into and argue that, I suppose. I mean, Russia has elections. Iran has elections. Certainly you could argue that there's manipulation that goes on in those countries and whatnot, but guess what? We could say that about our country as well. So, to categorize them as dictatorships, I think, is actually reflective of that pro-U.S. bias. As far as Israel is concerned, at least nominally, it does have a political democracy of sorts. The problem with Israel, of course, is that it really amounts to an apartheid regime, and in which the Palestinian people are denied political rights and so on. So, you could make the argument, well, it's not really a dictatorship; it's just extremely oppressive government. And again, it's
sure
reflective of the pro-U.S. bias of Freedom House.
Yeah, it just seems very clear from your reporting that the U.S. Gives military training and sells weapons or gives weapons to just about every dictatorship it can.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the people that have commented in the article, have pointed out that if you actually subtract, some of the political dictatorships that are listed by Freedom House, like Russia, Syria, Iran, and you actually take them off the list, well, then it's really more like 78% that we're supporting around the world. So it's actually maybe even worse than depicted in my article.
Yeah, and Syria is on there and in your chart, and it's blank, no training, no weapons. But several years back, that was not the case. The U.S. was selling weapons to Syria and collaborating with Syria on torturing prisoners and so forth, not long before Syria became a designated enemy. And that seems to be a trend and a possible future for some of the other countries that are on, including Yemen, that's on the list, because the list is a couple years old, and the U.S. is now assisting Saudi Arabia in bombing the hell out of Yemen.
Exactly, and you're absolutely right. This is part of a trend. Many of your listeners probably remember the famous picture of the defense secretary that was shaking
Rumsfeld.
Hands. Yeah, Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, and there's a almost as well-known photo of President Obama shaking hands with Muammar Gaddafi, and we're bombing the heck out of him a few years later, and for what?
And back a full circle to giving them aid. They're checked off on the list still. As of 2015, when you made this, so
exactly, yeah, they got him back on the pipeline once they put in. Well, actually, it doesn't even have, last I heard, much of a functioning government. But what government it does have is dictatorial in nature.
Yeah, yeah,
and warlords basically.
And I'm sure Ken Burns will be pleased to see Vietnam on the list as well.
Yeah, perhaps. That I haven't studied as well, but Freedom House did categorize them that way.
Yeah.
And you can go down this. A lot of part of the problem is that a lot of Americans aren't even well-versed in what's going on in these countries. Thailand's on the list, and, Thailand has been ruled by a military junta since 2014, and they've been detaining and trying civilians in military courts and all kinds of abuses going on. So, you can go down this, and it is subject certainly for a lot of further research and learning that, we as citizens, if we want to be informed, we don't have a Congress that's actually going to do its job. we the people need to be informed about what our government's doing.
Yeah. I wonder if you've looked into this. I think it would be an interesting addition. You've said you're going to do this annually, so, friendly amendment if you're inclined to add it. I wonder how many of these same dictatorships have significant U.S. troop presence, U.S. bases, and to what extent that plays a role. I mean, it seems the U.S. interest in having a base in Bahrain and having bases in Afghanistan, it may be part of why the U.S. is supporting these dictatorships and supporting them not just through the sale of weapons, but militarily supporting them against their own people, including in wars, in war participation, as with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually believe, David, it's on your website at davidswanson.org that you have, I think, some really good maps that I've seen, showing the countries where all the U.S. military bases are. And it's, depending on what you count as a base, it's, somewhere around 750 to 900. And, if you look at maps like that, guess what? It looks like an empire, doesn't it?
It sure does. Yeah, I've got a list at davidswanson.org compiled from various researchers of U.S. wars and U.S. bombings and U.S. overthrows, and I've added a link there to your article. But on worldbeyondwar.org, I have a collection of maps, and if you don't mind, I'll create one with this data and link to your article from the maps on World Beyond War.
That would be excellent.
As you've done this, has anybody, presented, the case in support of current policy, or does everyone just prefer to ignore it and not know about it? I mean, what is the argument in favor of U.S. militaries other than certain weapons companies getting rich? What's the argument for this?
Well, if there's an argument coming from the people of, the working people of this country, I certainly haven't seen it. I have received literally nothing but positive comments and feedback from this article. I think what you get from what I would refer to as the American ruling class, however, there's this notion that, well, our interests are the national interests, and our interests being the national interests, these include domination of resources, particularly oil, but not exclusively oil. And, if you look at this list, the ones that are getting the most money are typically the nations in the Middle East and some in Africa that have those kinds of resources. Huge. That's where the amounts get really huge. And it's kind of a familiar story at this point, but one that bears repeating is that's what this is really about, the identification of our national interest with the interests of big oil, the military-industrial complex, and other prevailing elements of the American ruling class that basically benefit from maintaining an empire. And that's really the larger point here, the larger context in which this policy arises.
And I don't know if you know any answer to this. I don't. But how do people avoid knowing anything about this and avoid knowing that U.S. weapons companies sell their weapons to all kinds of governments and imagine that the United States government is involved in spreading democracy when... I mean, I don't know what you would recommend for actually spreading democracy, but I would think the first step would be, stop supporting dictatorships.
Exactly. And, I wish I had a magic answer to your question, because if we had that, we probably, we'd probably have a much different country and different relations around the world than we do now. But, I attribute it. Part of it is simply ignorance, and it's calculated, and it's manufactured ignorance, somewhat along the lines of Noam Chomsky's manufactured consent. I mean, the prevailing corporate media in this country, the roughly six companies that dominate most of the news and information that people receive, They don't talk about this. They go along with this just assumption that we support democracy. And even when there is contrary information, they practice what some might call cognitive dissonance and just don't equate, you know, the contrary information with the narrative. And then on top of that, you know, the people do need to bear some responsibility too. If we aspire to be a democracy, and we are certainly not one now, but if we aspire to be one, that means that the citizens have to take some responsibility for doing a little homework and learning about these things and learning about what their government is up to.
Indeed, they do. Rich Whitney, do you think it would be appropriate to have a law passed by the U.S. Congress that forbid this? I know there's a law called the Leahy Law that forbids the United States, you know, actively participating in wars with militaries of countries that violate human rights. I don't know how you know, participate in a war without violating human rights, but, you know, that's the law as I understand it. But as I understand it, there's not any law that, you know, that forbids giving training or weaponry or preparations for wars to anybody at all.
That's correct, and that would be a useful vehicle, I think, for bringing about the change we need. But of course, that presupposes major changes in who our representatives are in Congress, and that gets us to a whole other discussion about how we go about changing that, because it's certainly not going to happen with the kind of Congress we have now and the what I refer to as the two corporate-sponsored parties that we have now. A few notable exceptions, of course, but by and large, they're supporting this overall agenda.
If we had a chart of which corporations are in the U.S. are selling weapons to dictatorships and which corporations are giving large amounts of money to political election campaigns, what do you think it would look like? I mean, how much would the overlap be?
Yeah, exactly. It would be quite a correlation. And of course, the military-industrial complex, which President Eisenhower warned us about it back in 1961 after he had helped create it for several decades. It's really just gotten incredibly worse. And there isn't a congressional district that doesn't have, you know, some of its fingers in the pie there. And so that's why you get these kinds of political results. But this is kind of a slightly different subject. But the other thing that I think American people need to know is, if you equate the military-industrial complex with jobs, folks need to look at the work that was done by those economists at the University of Massachusetts who pointed out that the same funds spent on practically anything else, whether it's education or healthcare or renewable energy or almost anything you can think of, the same billions of dollars spent on anything but the military would create far more jobs. So we do have a pathway. It's not as if we shut down the war machine that this country would have to suffer economically,
yeah.
Let alone the moral aspects of it. It would not have to. So we'd benefit economically if we shifted those resources.
And you even get more jobs, not the most jobs, but more jobs than military spending by never taxing that money from working people in the first place.
Exactly. Yes.
So it's actually a drain. It's actually a negative, which is, you know, everybody sees their neighbors with the military jobs and says, well, how can it be negative? But it is, because we could have more jobs and better jobs in every sense of the word better, I think.
Yeah, and that's not even, of course, getting into the moral dimensions of it. You know, to make an argument that, we're doing this horribly immoral thing, but there's jobs, people need to think about that. I mean, imagine if there was some sort of manufacturing that involved boiling kittens alive or something, right? Would people say, oh, well, they're boiling kittens alive, but at least it's a job, so we got to support boiling kittens alive. I mean, it's kind of like that. You got to get outside the fishbowl and take a look at the big picture of what we're doing as a society.
It seems that people stop thinking or refuse to think about things related to weaponry and militarism because it's not patriotic and patriotism is so important. Yet the whole idea of patriotism is supposed to be that your greatest country on earth is better than dictatorships, right? So
exactly, and of course that argument drives me crazy. We're seeing another variant of that today with the whole taking a knee before the Pledge of Allegiance thing, and it drives me crazy when I hear these people say, well, you know, you have the right to do that, but that's only because, our veterans, died to give you the right to do that protest.
Yeah.
Well, that's not, since World War II, at least, that's not what they died for, okay? They died to commit illegal acts of war in numerous other countries. You know, people need to have a grasp of reality and the truth of what our government has been doing, committing horrible crimes around the world for decades.
Yeah, I'm not a supporter of World War II either, but we'll need, five shows to go through that topic, and we've got just like 2 minutes left. What is the Green Party Peace Action Committee and other organizations you're working with doing these days?
Oh, well, there is so much to do. One thing that we're working on currently is right now, as a matter of fact, there is a No to War call to action marking the 16th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, which is now the longest foreign war in U.S. history. That's something to chew on right there. So there are actions nationwide that are going around. People can go to notowar.net and find out more about that. We're going to have a local one here in my little university town of Carbondale this Saturday, and there's much bigger ones going on in New York and elsewhere around the country. So there are opportunities for folks to step up and take a stand and be visible and say, no, I'm not going along with the permanent warfare state. I don't agree that it's a good idea to be occupying this country and continue to commit acts of war in this country that never attacked us.
None of these countries did. I have a list of events all over the world at worldbeyondwar.org, and if you send me any events happening in Illinois or anywhere else, we will add them and link to them there as well. We have just 30 seconds left. Where can people find out, keep in touch, check up for more information?
There is a public Facebook page. We're kind of restarting this committee. We're at kind of an early stage, but if you go to Green Party Peace Action Network, you can find, or Peace Network, rather, you can find out about that. As far as me personally, I have a regular blog spot at medium.com. You can always get in touch with me there. And, stay tuned. Hopefully I'll be back with another report before too much longer on U.S. support for dictatorships in fiscal year 2016.
Excellent. Rich Whitney, his article is called U.S. Provides Military Assistance to 73% of World's Dictatorships. Rich, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You're most welcome. It's been my pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a human rights nightmare continues to unfold in Myanmar as hundreds of thousands of Rohingya flee what a new UN report calls coordinated and systemic attacks by security forces and Buddhist mobs, only to arrive, if they arrive, to horrific conditions in refugee camps in Bangladesh. What human rights groups have called the ethnic cleansing of the religious and linguistic minority, the Myanmar government of Aung San Suu Kyi calls clearance operations, aimed solely at ousting militants. Though the Rohingya have lived in Myanmar for generations, the government of the Nobel Peace Prize recipient maintains that they are simply illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, where, as in Myanmar, Rohingya are denied citizenship. You may have seen or read some of what the UN calls bone-chilling accounts of the Rohingya people. What's the history behind those accounts? Azim Ibrahim is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy and author of The Rohingyas, Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. He'll join us for an extended conversation about the roots of the current crisis and where we go from here. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. There is no shortage of human trauma around the world. It's hard to take it all in. But leave it to corporate media to stoke some anxiety just to serve their own worldview. Listeners know Puerto Rico was already in dire straits after years of crushing debt and imposed austerity when Hurricane Maria devastated the island in September. On October 3rd, Donald Trump, in what appeared to be an uncharacteristic display of empathy, said that Puerto Rico's $72 billion debt would have to be forgiven. Though the president's statement was quickly walked back by administration officials, the idea of forgiving Puerto Rico's debt is actually gaining political strength. And, as Owen Higgins notes for Fair.org, in response to that push for debt forgiveness, corporate media are trying a new tactic, telling the American people that they own the debt and they'll be on the hook. Sure, majorities of Puerto Rico's population are still without power or clean drinking water, but for New York Times financial journalist Aaron Ross Sorkin, that's not the whole story. Appearing on MSNBC's midday Saturday show, Velshi and Rule, Sorkin declared, quote, "So there's two issues. There's the humanitarian issue in Puerto Rico, and to some degree, there's a humanitarian issue on the other side of who owns those bonds, which is basically all of us." Close quote. In reality, hedge funds own about a quarter of the debt. Many so-called predator funds that buy debt from the beleaguered at cents on the dollar and then try to extract as much as they can. The rest is held mainly by retail investors, individuals with the resources to purchase stocks and bonds themselves. That's about 500,000 American bondholders, not in a country of 325 million, basically all of us. But that line is gaining steam in the corporate media. Who really has exposure to Puerto Rican bonds? Asked CNBC, answering, chances are you do. CNN Money reporter Matt Egan told readers that after the chunk held by hedge funds, quote, the rest of the debt is owned by individuals and mutual funds that are held by mom-and-pop investors, close quote. Well, the spate of reports are basing their presentation on comments from one person, financial reporter Kate Long of the website Puerto Rico Clearinghouse. In many stories, no other source is cited. Corporate media don't really require evidence to promote the portrayal of financial interests that benefit a minority of wealthy Americans as representing the entire country, and even to reject the idea that wealthy investors should actually take the losses that are a normal consequence of risky investments. Even for them, though, calling the possibility of debt forgiveness for storm-ravaged Puerto Rico a humanitarian issue for investors is a new low. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Rohingya continue to arrive in Bangladesh, part of a wave of those fleeing repressive violence in neighboring Myanmar, where decades of persecution of the religious and linguistic minority by the country's military leadership have escalated to a campaign human rights groups are using terms like ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity to describe. Indeed, there are reportedly more Rohingya in Bangladesh now than in Myanmar, after what the government of Nobel Peace Prize recipient Aung San Suu Kyi called clearance operations, which she said were aimed solely at uprooting Rohingya militants. She also contends the exodus is lightening and that Rohingya who return will have their needs met. Meanwhile, the international community seems poised to intervene, but what would a helpful response look like? And how are we to understand the roots of the current crisis? Azeem Ibrahim is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy and author of The Rohingyas, Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Azeem Ibrahim.
Thanks so much for having me.
Many news reports peg the beginning of the current crisis as August 25th, when, in Reuters' words, quote, attacks by Rohingya militants on security posts in Rakhine State sparked a ferocious military response, close quote. That sets the clock a certain way in terms of who is acting and who is reacting, however disproportionately. But this latest wave of violence and desperate flight was preceded by years of violence and flight, at least back to 2012, and then in some ways the stage was set decades before. What is some of the deeper historical context that we should understand as lying in back of this crisis that we're seeing right now?
The Rohingya have been claimed by the United Nations as the most persecuted minority in the world. They have faced wave after wave of violence over the last half century. The most recent wave that we're seeing on our TV screens, which started on the 25th of August, as you mentioned, is probably the worst that we have seen. But the persecution can actually be dated back to the Second World War, when the Japanese invaded what was at that time British Burma. The majority Buddhist population sided with the Japanese invaders, believing that this would lead to swifter independence after the Japanese were victorious. But the minority Rohingya population stayed loyal to the British colonial masters. So after the war ended and the British were victorious, there was bad blood between the two people. But despite that, there was relative calm up until 1962, when there was a military coup by a general called Ne Win. And he essentially tried to implement what he called the Burmese Road to Socialism, which was a communist manifesto. And this was a complete economic disaster. So he did what a lot of dictators do in that situation, is that they try to find scapegoats. They try to find people or groups to blame all the ills of society on. And the Rohingya minority, they were already seen with suspicion, were the minority of choice for this. He also became much more overtly Buddhist in his outlook. He started funding monasteries, he started supporting extreme Buddhist clergy and so on, till eventually he began to say that only Buddhists can be loyal citizens of this country. And he passed a number of laws, which then culminated in the 1982 Citizenship Act, which stripped all the Rohingya of their nationality, making them stateless. A recent Harvard study before the current crisis has indicated that 1 in 7 stateless people around the globe are of Rohingya origin. The persecution can be traced back a long way, and the most recent wave is just the worst that we've seen.
Well, beyond the denial of legal citizenship, Aung San Suu Kyi says, don't even use the term Rohingya, you know, and a representative of Suu Kyi's party told The Voice of America, quote, in our history, there is no Rohingya, close quote. It's really kind of an attempt, it seems, at a cultural erasure as well.
Absolutely. And this is the crux of the problem, is that the Myanmar authorities do not believe that the term Rohingya is a genuine term. So if you listen to any of their addresses, including Aung San Suu Kyi, they will never use the term Rohingya. They'll refer to them as Muslims in Rakhine, or they'll refer to them as Bengalis. In fact, Aung San Suu Kyi was pressed by the BBC's Fair Gukin to say the word, to just say the word Rohingya a number of times, and she refuses to say it. And this is one of the things I try to examine in my book, is the veracity of the claims behind the fact that what the Myanmar authorities or the extreme Buddhist clergy say is that this term Rohingya was actually manufactured in 1942. And before that time, this term did not exist. And these people are all illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. So one of the things I did was I actually dug up documents from the Indian National Archive in New Delhi in India, where in the time when the British ruled Burma, they did extensive surveys and extensive research into the makeup of that region. And it's very clearly documents dating back to 1824 under a civil servant called Charles Patton from the British Colonial Office. It states very clearly that one in three souls in that region, in the Arakan region, is of Rohingya origin. And some historians trace back their origin up to 8 centuries. And so this idea that they're all illegal immigrants from Bangladesh who made up this name Rohingya is patently false and does not stand up to historical scrutiny.
Well, you had written before August 25th, the worry now is what happens if there's some kind of trigger. Obviously, this situation had been going on for a long time, but you were concerned about something that would push it into a new realm. And so you're suggesting then that although it is of a piece in a way with what's gone before, this latest crisis is indeed something new?
Yeah. As you said, I wrote a number of pieces in even last year. I wrote a piece in Newsweek warning that the military is on maneuvers now. They're gearing up of a massive offensive of ethnic cleansing to get rid of what they call the Rohingya problem once and for all. So all they needed was a trigger. So the military now claim that they're reacting to militant attacks on the 25th of August. But the reality is that they have been preparing for this for a long time. General Min Aung Hlaing, the commander-in-chief of the Burmese armed forces, was actually on a spending spree to buy military equipment to Germany and Austria. And I wrote a letter to both of their ambassadors, which is now in the public domain. I published it online in May, before the current crisis, warning that the military chief is actually purchasing armaments, leading up for a massive offensive. And this is precisely what happened. So a lot of Myanmar watchers, a lot of Burma watchers, knew exactly what was going on. And in fact, Min Aung Hlaing said days into the crisis that what he is doing is unfinished business from 1942 to get the illegal Bengalis from this country.
Well, refugees arriving in Bangladesh and to a lesser extent in Thailand are reporting entire villages burned, people being shot indiscriminately. It's very clear why they would leave, but we need to recognize, don't we, that arrival at a camp, for example, in Bangladesh, certainly it does not imply safety.
No, absolutely not. And I have visited the camps both in Burma and on the Bangladeshi side. And I can tell you that the camps on both sides are absolutely horrific in terms of the facilities and in terms of just catering for human beings. The difficulty now is that over the last month or so, we've had the latest figure is 516,000 people cross over the border. This brings the total to over 800,000 just in Bangladesh. And a country like Bangladesh, which is already overpopulated, is quite poor, simply cannot absorb those kind of numbers. And now we have starvation and malnutrition setting in, along with disease such as cholera and diarrhea. So out of those 516,000, we know that the figures are up to 260,000 are children. And amongst those, at the very least, we know that 9,000 are children without any parents. So they don't have any guardians. The parents have been killed or either they're lost. So we have starvation and malnutrition setting in. So this is quite accurately described as one of the worst humanitarian crises of our time.
Well, we have seen some harrowing reporting coming from the camps, which I have appreciated for sort of showing its seams. You know, we're hearing reporters describe the difficulties of getting access. A reporter, Aaron Kilbride, talked about refugee stories and noted that the types of injuries showing up in Bangladesh border camps corroborate stories of civilians shot from behind as they fled, which is very important when folks are getting conflicting reports. And the Washington Post's Max Barak was able to counter Suu Kyi's claim that the exodus had quieted down and that people were carrying on as normal in Rakhine State by listening to refugee cell phone calls to the area from the camps in Bangladesh, which he describes very poignantly. And he adds that there are only three spots where you can actually get cell phone service, and that Rohingya refugees who've been at the camps for decades have shown the new arrivals exactly where to stand to make calls. That's the kind of detail that really crushes. But if field reporters can vividly convey the crisis, where and how we direct our focus matters very much. And here I want to cite a Washington Post editorial, which vehemently condemns Myanmar's military for their entirely disproportionate response. Inflicting such misery on a whole population is intolerable, and they demand the Rohingya must be allowed to return immediately. It's hard not to notice that these are not principles that the paper applies universally. But in this case, the Post and other U.S. media are very much in do-something mode. And the narrative helps determine what folks think makes sense to do and what they'll support. I wonder if you could talk about what narrative is important to carry forward. I mean, partly it has to do with reimagining who Aung San Suu Kyi is.
Yeah, this has been one of the difficulties, is that the Western press and leaders are completely baffled by the behavior of Aung San Suu Kyi. You know, at the very outset of this crisis, she not only remained silent, but she actually overtly supported the military. She essentially become a shield for the military and giving them tacit support verbally. Very recently, she gave a big speech to the international audience after she pulled out of attending the General Assembly at the UN. And the speech was given in English, so it was aimed at the global community. And it was quite bizarre from a number of perspectives. First of all, she claimed that she had no idea why the Rohingya were leaving, and that she invited international partners to come to Myanmar and join her to try to find out. And this, I think most people found this quite bizarre, because we can see the villages burning from Bangladesh. You know, and this is burning on an industrial scale. Human Rights Watch has obtained satellite images showing entire villages completely burnt. And the next day after they burnt down, the militias and the security forces come back to burn down the remaining houses that are left. So it's quite evident why the people are actually leaving. But the interesting thing was that she invited the international community to come and investigate with her. And she said this very explicitly. And this is after, earlier this year, you know, in March of this year, the United Nations passed a resolution for a full-scale humanitarian Human Rights Commission inquiry. And it was Aung San Suu Kyi herself that said, and I quote you, that this will not be very helpful. And as the foreign minister of that country, she blocked the United Nations from coming. She refused to give them visas. And even after the speech, when she invited the international community to come and join her, she refused to let the UN in. So she says one thing in the public domain, but privately she's essentially undertaking a policy to ensure that there's no access whatsoever to the international media. And one commentator actually told me when I was in Washington recently, it was actually a congressman, he said, well, the reason why they're not letting international observers in is very simple. It's because they'll end up in The Hague. They know exactly what they're doing. They want to ensure that their entire operation of ethnically cleansing the entire Rohingya population is complete before anybody finds out. And they have a systematic and organized campaign to ethnically cleanse the entire Rohingya population, burn down their villages to make sure that they don't ever come back.
Well, you have written about previous supposed investigations into violence taken by the Myanmar government, one of which concluded both sides are to blame, which is going to sound very familiar to Americans right at this moment. But you've said that external players really have to play a role here. You know, there's a tendency sometimes to say this is a sovereign country and you know, folks who are critical of outside intervention. And I know the EU Foreign Ministers Council is set to discuss Myanmar on October 16th. What do you see as appropriate interventions or appropriate roles for the external players?
I think there has to be some sort of penalty and some sort of sanction on Myanmar for ignoring the United Nations in this kind of fashion, particularly when they engage in industrial-scale ethnic cleansing and what many people would call genocide. The difficulty is that a lot of Western leaders are unwilling to put too much pressure on Myanmar because they believe that this country has emerged from a brutal military dictatorship and it's now become much more democratic. And they don't want to put too much pressure on Aung San Suu Kyi because they don't want the country to go back to being a military dictatorship. They don't want a military coup. But this is actually a myth that's being perpetuated by Aung San Suu Kyi's friends and supporters. The reality is that there's almost no chance of a military coup happening in Myanmar. The military is actually in a very, very good position right now. They created the political system as it stands. They still wield considerable influence. They still control the major ministries. They still control a quarter of the seats in parliament. Aung San Suu Kyi is not the president. She's the state councillor, a position that they created to ensure that she doesn't have complete power. And at the same time, the military was very, very unpopular, and they were forced to hold elections, elections that Aung San Suu Kyi won with 80%. So 80% of the people are behind her, and now they can engage in ethnic cleansing without any international kind of scrutiny and pressure, whilst Aung San Suu Kyi becomes the lightning rod that defends them and attracts that international criticism. So they're in a very good situation. The last thing they want to do is upset that balance and attract international criticism. So the chances of a military coup are very, very slim. But we in the international community have refused to undertake very simple kinds of action that we could do to actually put more pressure on the Myanmar authorities. One thing, for example, we could do is that President Obama was a little bit premature when he lifted all unilateral sanctions against Myanmar, and he did that by executive order. It's my understanding that that can be reversed relatively easily, and this would hurt the military quite considerably, because the military in Myanmar is not just a fighting military, it's actually a massive business enterprise that's profiting immensely from the lifting of sanctions.
Well, it reminds me also of a piece I saw by sociologist Saskia Sassen, in which she noted that land grabs are also accompanying forced displacement, and that she's referred to military economic interests. We always have to remember there are many factors in play. And in October 8th, Reuters piece reminded me of that. Speaking of the U.S. administration, quote, "The administration wanted to send a strong message to Myanmar's military, but was concerned that too drastic action could allow China to expand its growing diplomatic and economic influence in the country." Close quote. To me, that's just another kind of reminder that as human beings, our understanding of human rights can't be entirely determined by the definitions or actions of political leaders.
You're absolutely right. This is one of the larger geopolitical calculations going on behind the scenes. When President Obama visited Myanmar in 2012, you know, for any country to get a visit from the President of the United States is quite a big deal for that country. President Obama visited, and Aung San Suu Kyi then came to the United Nations to give a speech, and then she visited Obama at the White House, and Obama lifted all sanctions off Myanmar. And one of the reasons they did that is that as Myanmar becomes open, emerges from a military dictatorship, the US is deeply concerned that it's falling under the sphere of influence of China. The whole of Southeast Asia is being reconfigured to meet one purpose, and that's to meet China's insatiable demand for resources. China is the biggest investor in many of those countries. In Pakistan, for example, China has invested over $56 billion. And if you go to Pakistan, you'll see roads, highways, ports, bridges, everything being built by Chinese money. And it's a similar situation in Myanmar, you know, that China is the biggest investor there as well. And as it opens up, the US is deeply concerned that this will give access to China to the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean. Thus, they're able to surround India. It's another nuclear power that's in rivalry with China over control of that region. So this will change the strategic calculus of that region dramatically. So when you have geopolitical machinations going on such as this behind the scenes, then you insert the persecution of this unknown group called the Rohingya. It simply doesn't fit into that calculation.
We know that folks are very much thinking of the hardship happening today. The images that are coming out, such as they are from Bangladesh camps, and it's clear that Bangladesh does not want to be seen as the solution. The PBS NewsHour reported a local official in Bangladesh saying, you know, the Rohingyas aren't developed. Their character is uncivilized. We're different from them. If they continue coming like this, it will lead to destruction. Clearly, this is not a tenable situation. Just on the immediate human rights nightmare front, you know, what do you see happening or what could happen in that regard?
This is the real challenge now, is that we have literally, you know, 800,000 refugees in camps in Bangladesh. And the Bangladeshi government has been very generous in terms of allowing them in. Since the 1990s, they've had a policy of not allowing any Rohingya refugees in simply because it encourages more of them to come. And this is precisely what the Myanmar authorities actually want. They've actually said that we want all the Rohingya to leave. from some third country should just take them in. Bangladeshi government was right not to encourage this, but at the same time, they have opened their doors to allow those refugees. And the difficulty is that they are now confined to these massive camps in the hope that they'll someday go back to Myanmar. And they don't allow them to leave the camps, so they're not given refugee status. The difficulty is that the probability of them going back to Myanmar is very, very slim. So we have a situation in which the Rohingya were being persecuted in Myanmar, and now they've crossed over the border. They might have escaped direct violence, but they're now confined to these concentration camps in Bangladesh, from which they're not permitted to leave either. So they had no future in Myanmar, and it seems that, you know, them and their children will have no future in Bangladesh either, by the looks of it.
I was struck, I don't know what to make of it, I was struck by a little thread I was seeing in reporting that now Suu Kyi's office is saying, well, internally displaced Bengalis, of course, they can return home, and the government will provide their needs to build and reconstruct their homes. You know, it almost sounds like a setup to say that those who did return, well, then they aren't really refugees. I don't quite understand what the gambit is there by pretending that the Myanmar government will provide food and security for Rohingyas that return.
Yeah. You have to look at the criteria by which they allow the Rohingya to return. So I've looked at it. Aung San Suu Kyi said in a famous speech that, you know, the Rohingya will be permitted to return if they can prove that they're from Myanmar. But the kind of criteria they have to meet, not even the Buddhist or anybody, not a single citizen in Myanmar could probably meet that criteria. Just to give you an example, they have to produce birth certificates of their grandfather. At a time when birth certificates were never issued. They have to produce paperwork from the village that they're resident from. And they've not been residents since 1982. They've been non-citizens. Then they have to produce paperwork of where they crossed the border in Bangladesh. So basically passports with passport stamps. So nobody can meet that kind of criteria. This is just designed to obfuscate and confuse the international community to say that, look, we're doing what we can to allow the Rohingya back in. They're all welcome to come back. But to meet that criteria is just impossible.
We've been speaking with Azeem Ibrahim, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Policy. His book is The Rohingyas, Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. Thank you, Azeem Ibrahim, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I've got a real mix for you. We'll talk with atmospheric scientist Charles Bardeen about the day the Earth burned. From Texas, I'll ask Grow Your Own Groceries gardener Marjorie Wildcraft about how she weathered Hurricane Harvey. We'll end with a shocking warning for the Northern Hemisphere from Danish scientist Jorgen Stephenson. But first, a sad voice from the front lines of climate change. The island of Dominica was a jewel in the Caribbean. All that green was wiped away by the Category 5 Hurricane Maria, powered by hotter-than-normal seas. Even as the islanders struggled out of the wreckage of their homes and lives, their prime minister made it to the United Nations in New York. He spoke these words to a nearly empty chamber where few cared about the end of Eden.
Mr. President, I come to you straight from the front line of the war on climate change. Mr. President, warmer air and sea temperatures have permanently altered the climate between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. Heat is the fuel that takes ordinary storms, storms we could normally muster or master in our sleep, and supercharges them into a devastating force. In the past, we will prepare for one heavy storm a year. Now, thousands of storms form on a breeze in the mid-Atlantic and line up to pound us with maximum force and fury. Before this century, no other generation had seen more than one Category 5 hurricane in their lifetime. In this century, this has happened twice, and notably, it has happened in the space of just 2 weeks. And may I add, Mr. President, that we are only midway into this year's hurricane season. In the case of Dominica, it has been only 2 years since we lost lives and endured substantial physical and infrastructural damage from the ravages of floods and mudslides of Tropical Storm Erica. Mr. President, to deny climate change is to procrastinate while the earth sinks. It is to deny a truth we have just lived. It is to mock thousands of my compatriots who, in a few hours, without a roof over their heads, will watch the night descend on Dominica in fear of sudden mudslides and what the next hurricane may bring. We as a country and as a region did not start this war against nature. We did not provoke it. The war has come to us. Mr. President, my fellow leaders, there is no more time for conversation. There is little time left for action. While the big countries talk, the small island nations suffer. We need action, and we need it now, Mr. President. We in the Caribbean do not produce greenhouse gases or sulfate aerosols. We do not pollute or overfish our oceans. We have made no contribution to global warming that can move the needle. But yet, we are among the main victims on the front line. In the Commonwealth of Dominica, we have long pursued and respected an existence that preserves our little Eden. The Mont Tropitans has been a national park for 40 years and a UNESCO World Heritage Site for 20. Our livelihoods are part of our ecosystem. This is how my people and my country earn and survive. But what is our reality at this moment? Pure devastation. As Dominicans bear the brunt of climate change, I repeat, we are shouldering the consequences of the actions of others, actions that endanger our very existence, and all for the enrichment of a few elsewhere. Mr. President, we dug graves today in Dominica. We buried loved ones yesterday, and I am sure that as I return home tomorrow, we shall discover additional fatalities as a consequence of this encounter. Our homes are flattened, our buildings roofless, our water pipes smashed, and road infrastructure destroyed. Our hospital is without power, and schools have disappeared beneath the rubble. Our crops are uprooted. Where there was green, there is now only dust and dirt. The desolation is beyond imagination. Mr. President, fellow leaders, the stars have fallen. Eden is broken.
That was a selection from the speech made September 27th by the Prime Minister of Dominica, Roosevelt Skerrit. Find a link to the whole speech in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Can anyone prepare for emergencies like Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico? How did Texas preppers do in Hurricane Harvey? Whatever trying times may come, Marjorie Wildcraft has helped hundreds of thousands get on the pathway to resilience and a better life. Marjorie founded the GROW Network. She's the host of the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. Marjorie has been featured in National Geographic magazine. Her DVD series, Grow Your Own Groceries, is phenomenally popular, as are her many YouTube videos. Marjorie, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me back on. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I know that you and your family have a homestead in Central Texas. What did you experience of Hurricane Harvey?
Yeah, we had about 19 inches of rain come in about a little over a 24-hour period. We had actually prepared for a lot worse. And actually, our house is not that, you know, high above ground, and we've seen in the past where water could come in. And my husband had, last year, he had built a retaining wall and like a big French drain all around the house. Now, you got to realize that Texas has been in a drought for the last, I don't know how many years, so people were looking at him like he was nuts, you know, building this retaining wall and French drain. And then, of course, we came through the whole flooding just fine. There's no problems at all. The water diverted beautifully. You know, I mean, 19 inches of rain is a lot for anybody. And my friend said, how did he know? And I said, it's really simple. Texas weather is totally predictable. It's long periods of drought punctuated by severe flooding. So he knew it was coming. We just had a long drought, you know. Central Texas, they had actually predicted it to be a lot worse, and Harvey didn't quite hit us as hard. But the coastal cities and then that reversal where it went into Houston, that was just really unexpected. And that was a really a much more horrific situation, which it could be interesting to see how that unfolds economically over the years. I know, I have a lot of family in South Florida also, and I know when Hurricane Andrew did such devastation in South Florida, I thought, oh, you know, what's going to happen here? Well, it turned out being a big boon to South Florida because all the insurance money that came flooding in. But in Houston, about 85% of the buildings and houses there that were flooded out did not have flood insurance. So I'm really going to be watching. I think this is going to be a lot harder of a hit economically, you know, just because of that aspect of it, right? There isn't the funding that's in place. You know, FEMA, forget it. We're not really getting much out of that, right?
Right. And, you know, the media's almost stopped covering it as they move on to the next big storm in Puerto Rico or something else, the NFL and Trump. And I'm worried about Houston. I'm worried that Americans won't pour in the support that's really needed in many ways.
I too am worried because that's a climate there where mold is, you know, even most of the floodwaters have drained off now, but there's, you know, you've got everything is saturated with water and mold is a huge issue. It's a, you know, Texas is still a very warm climate. You know, even last week we had, you know, up in the upper 90s, and in Houston that's the same temperature. Those are the ideal conditions. And then, of course, you know, Houston is this horrible environmental disaster waiting to happen with all the oil refineries and all the different things, you know, that can leak and get loose and the chemical situation there. So I too, am very, very worried about Houston.
Did you hear of any examples where the prepper lifestyle helped Texans with Hurricane Harvey? What are they saying after that?
You know, I think that you have to have a prepper lifestyle always. You know, with the way things are changing so fast, and even if it's not going to be a natural disaster, if it's not going to be, you know, economic collapse or something like that, it could just be personal. You know, there were lots of people in 2008 that just lost a job or something, and that's, you know, that's devastating. So being prepared with having, you know, some sources of food or, you know, tradable skills or things that you can do, you know, having some preparations in place and preparing that radical change can come is always a good idea. And, yeah, you know, the people who had prepared for this ahead of time, you know, they fared much better. People who had already had stocks of sandbags to put around their house or, you know, things that they had done to make sure, like we did, to make sure that much water wasn't going to flood them out, they do much better. My family, as I said, I've got a lot of family, and my family down in South Florida especially, you know, the power went out. It was out for more than a week where they lived, and, you know, they had backup generator and a way to do water filtration and, you know, rain catchment. Funny that you'd need that in a hurricane with so many inches coming at you, but you do. right? So all the things, you know, backup food supplies. So, yes, in general, people who are prepared do better.
You know, here's one odd little point that you've just stimulated in my brain here. People forget when the power goes out or maybe the roof gets blown off that cooking isn't easy or possible. And for that, I really recommend storing rice. Rice can be soaked overnight and then you can eat it without cooking. It doesn't taste very good, but it keeps you alive.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great tip. And then, you know, there's lots of little ways you can make stoves or, you know, get some firewood together or figure something out. But having maybe a little, you know, your normal propane tank with your barbecue grill, you know, prepping doesn't have to be something extra. It can be something that you just have all the time as a part of your lifestyle, right? So having the grill and always having an extra tank on hand, that's just, you know, just makes sense. You know, don't let your fuel get in your tank in your car less than half a tank, right? So you've always got, that was another thing that was fascinating was I think it just blew up on social media. They were talking about, well, the refineries are going to shut down. And it just within hours, all the gas stations had these huge, huge lines. And it was really unnecessary. But, you know, those flash mob type things can really get out of hand with the social media and all the instant messaging and texting we have with our cell phone systems now.
I remember in New England when Hurricane Irene hit there, it was in August in 2011, and that flooded out a lot of homes, but it also flooded out a lot of gardens. How can you prepare gardens for the kind of rain that you got with Harvey?
The way we prepared was I have my gardens on a bit of a hillside so that I know the water is going to drain off well. But you do have to be prepared, and one way to prepare is to have multiple food sources. I'll tell you a story of I went to the Permaculture Institute, which is a group that's just north of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I went there because they had this old established food forest, these old apricot trees and apple trees and all these beautiful fruit and nut trees that had been producing for years, and they had this little irrigation system that they would divert water and flood irrigate them from time to time. They loved that, and that was like their primary thing. But they also had some livestock. They had goats and sheep and chickens, and that was another food source for them. But they weren't real big on the annual gardens. It wasn't a part of their thing. You know, the permaculturists often tend to want to focus toward perennials and toward meat. Well, and I was there with Arena Putman, just really delightful woman who runs it with Scott. And one winter, they had a freak storm that got to, like, I don't know, some negative number, right, below zero. And their old trees didn't die, gratefully. You know, they were large diameter trees. But it did, you know, all the younger growth on the most of the branches did die off, and they did not have any production for at least a year because the trees were severely, you know, set back with that cold of a temperature. And Arena, she was like, you know, you really do need to have annual gardens because you can get something up and going and, you know, some crops in depending in just a month, but others in 3 months. So you really want to have diversity is my belief. Also, as a gardener, I would say, you know, you get wiped out from time to time with a garden regardless of flooding. You know, sometimes just some strange insect thing will happen or, you know, that bizarre freeze you didn't expect. And that's happening more and more, interestingly enough. I'm getting reports from gardeners and farmers around the world that, the, you know, with the weather patterns changing, you just have to recognize that we're starting to see more bizarre losses and getting used to that, planting for resilience, right?
And having the seeds around to replace what you can do and knowing how to grow things that grow fast, like bok choy or whatever, things are going to produce for you pretty quickly if you have to replace a garden.
Yeah, that's it. But, you know, having the seeds are the wonderful thing, but really the experience is much more valuable. But seed saving is definitely an important piece of that.
Now, you've got a kind of interactive video series going with your Grow Network folks to get a new book ready. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm writing a book, and it's called Grow, All True Wealth Comes from the Ground. And something you may not have known about me is years ago, I don't know if you've ever heard of Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yes.
But years before he became famous, I was a student of his. And it was when I was an expat living out in Asia. This is before husband and children. I was footloose and fancy free out in Asia having a good time doing all this consulting work. And my friend said, you got to check out this crazy guy, Robert Kiyosaki. And I went, like, wow, this guy is really making some sense here. So let me tell you. So I was one of the distinctions that I got from Robert was, you know, even as a consultant, I was just making money per hour, right? And I wanted to learn how to have money make money. So I became a professional investor, and that's when I moved back to the U.S., and I was doing that for a while and doing really, really well with it. And then I predicted, and this was in the early 2000s, I predicted that what happened in 2008 was going to happen. I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, we're borrowing all this money from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and their business model just doesn't look good to me. And I'd not only put all my money into this investment thing, but I had investors, right? You know, OPM, right? Other people's money. And people had trusted me. And we had this whole thing, the corporation and all these limited partnerships. And I went to all my investors and I said, look, I really think that this whole thing is going to come apart. I think we need to unwind this whole real estate business, because if you're going to be successful in real estate, you're going to be borrowing a lot of money. And we did. We were managing, I think, about $8 to $10 million in debt at that time. And so I managed to convince all of them to unwind it. And it took a couple of years, and we completely unwound that business. And that's when I started saying, what happens during economic collapse? And I was so grateful that I was actually early with my forecast, because we had pretty much unwound everything by 2003. And, of course, we all know that 2008 was when it happened. But I also, in that journey of like really unwinding that and looking at money and the whole thing, and I began to realize wealth really isn't about money, which is, you know, something I think we all know at some level. But for me, I really got it in a big way. So I'm writing this book all about what real wealth is, which is completely contrary to everything Robert Kiyosaki taught. So, you know, it's not about real estate and bank accounts and fast cars, but it's really about your health, right? You know, what if you're wealthy, if you have a ton of money, what good is that if you're coughing and hacking and you've got to go around with an oxygen thing or an IV on your arm, right? You know, having your health is way more important than having a lot of money. Family. You know, how having a loving family, you know, a husband or wife that you great relationships and good times with your kids and community, and having a group of people that you regularly interact with and support and work with, and they do the same with you. And then meaningful work, doing something that's really like a part of your life purpose. That's a form of wealth. And then the final thing is really coming into your life purpose and living from that. That is the ultimate wealth. So this is all a book about those five things. And Alex, all of them can come from the ground. You know, your health is absolutely something you can grow yourself. And a healthy family, all of our family traditions really come from mealtimes, eating together. And when you do things together, like do things with your kids, you know, you can go to the roller skating rink or you can go to the movies. But if you take your kids in a garden and go maybe collect eggs or, you know, do something like that, I guarantee you that those memories are going to stay with them, and the bond between you will be much deeper than the roller skating rink, right? And then working with your community, growing food together with other people is unbelievably, you know, it develops bonds and relationships that you'll never get just by joining the bowling league or you know, whatever other forms of community that were your Facebook friends, right? And then meaningful work. We have completely got to reimagine and recreate the entire food supply and the entire medical system that we have. The industrial medical system is, quite frankly, just killing people. So we need a bevy of trained herbalists and nutritionists and, you know, chiropractors and people to grow herbs and people to make tinctures and all the different aspects of health that even way beyond what I'm even imagining or discussing here. And the same thing with food. We really have to have more people producing food, meaningful food, cottage industry, local food, you know, animal products, vegetables. So the whole, and then of course, you know, all the processing that goes with that of the making of the fermented vegetables and all the, you know, kimchi and kombucha and all the different things that you do with the food things. So we have got to recreate an entire food system and an entire medical system that's based on something that's real and holistic and sustainable. And in that is opportunities for tremendous amounts of meaningful work, right? Going to work every day, growing food, or going to work every day growing medicine, or going to work every day making medicine, or healing with people, or, you know, setting up a distribution system for local foods, or, you know, the different ways that you can work. That is so meaningful. I'll tell you right now, with the Grow Network, we have just brought on our eighth full-time employee. And anytime, this is how hungry people are for meaningful work, because the Grow Network, the purpose of the Grow Network is to stop the destruction of the earth, right?
Right.
And our catalyzing statement is homegrown food on every table. Commercial agriculture is the most destructive force on the planet. We are absolutely desertifying vast areas of this planet for the sake of growing corn, soybeans, and wheat. And so people want meaningful work. And when I put out and say, look, I'm looking for an affiliate manager, or I'm looking for even an IT guy, or, you know, an editor or whatever, we get a minimum of about 300 applicants. People really want to do things that are meaningful. There's a real hunger for that. And, you know, we all know that things have got to change. Why not create work and do work that's meaningful, right? God, there's nothing worse than going to work just for a paycheck. Isn't that terrible?
It is, but I've done it. We've done it. But I now am doing something that I really love and believe in. I'm doing self-sufficient radio EcoShock, and that's what you're tuned to hear. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Marjorie Wildcraft. She's the Texas homesteader who founded the Grow Network, and she also hosts the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. Now, I watched your DVD series, and now I hear that it's being used by people much beyond American homesteaders. How does the homegrown tech that you're developing get communicated and applied in other countries? Maybe you talked about missionary organizations, but how is it being used in the developing world?
Yeah, there are missionary organizations that are using the video. There's also a lot that's happening in South America with it. I'm so surprised, and they're translating it. I created all of that in my homestead in Central Texas, and I got to tell you a little story about it. When we first bought it, you know, we didn't know anything really about growing food. I mean, I don't have any background in growing food. Like I said, I was a money manager and before that, I was an engineer, right? And we fell in love with this piece of land that has terrible soil. It's just sandy soil, no water, you know. And then Central Texas has like this insane climate that changes all the time. In fact, Peter Bain of the Permaculture Activist magazine, he said, Marjorie, you're actually located in the perfect spot to figure out how to grow food for all the rest of us when climate change becomes a huge reality for everyone else. And it's all changing so much all the time. And nobody has any soil or water. And I said, thank you, Peter. Now that I know better, I think I would like to move somewhere else. But but we created that there. And what I began to realize was that there are principles of growing food. And one of the principles is you really do need good soil. Most of us who don't grow any food at all, we just think that that's there to hold the plant up, right? You know, the seed packet says put it in the ground and water it and come back in 90 days and get your broccoli. It doesn't talk anything about good soil, but you really need good soil. And it took me a long time to realize that principle. And that principle is applicable everywhere. It's applicable in Africa. It's applicable in New Zealand. It's applicable in Ireland, in Montana, in Toronto, you know, in Texas. And I think that's why the DVD has had such wide appeal, is because I showed how I implemented it in Texas, but the principles are all throughout the whole video that are applicable anywhere. Yes, and we've had university organizations use it as a part of some coursework. And definitely groups, and there's one group in South America that I'm thinking of. Actually, it was in Cuba. I went to Cuba quite a few years ago and left them a bunch of videos, and they are working also quite quickly on sustainable agriculture. They've been doing a lot for years since they had their collapse, and they really appreciated it there. What groups often do is there's like 8 sections to the video, and often they'll watch one section, and which will be a 10 or 15 minute section, and then their group locally will talk about you know, well, Marjorie is that species because she's in Texas. What is the equivalent plants we have in our region? Or, you know, she talked about this, or who has that in the neighborhood? You know, like she used these kind of chickens because they're used to tolerating heat. But, you know, we're up here in Maine, and the different varieties of chickens are going to do better in the cold. And, you know, what food, you know, so they translated into their region, and it's a great networking thing, too, because, you know, so-and-so, Bob down the road, he's got those chickens like that, right? You know, let's go see if we can get some from him. I've been really surprised. I was really surprised and shocked at the success of the video, to be honest with you, Alex, because really, I mean, it's a video about growing food, right? You know, like who would have thought a video like that would go viral?
Well, I used it. I watched your calculations about water storage from the roof, and I installed a 250-gallon water tank to catch our eaves trough water. And when we got into a drought situation here this year where the water levels got so low, they said, you're going to have to stop watering your garden. I would never do that. That's my grocery store. But I had this extra rainwater collected, and that was just enough to get me through until it rained again.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, those calculations are applicable everywhere on the planet. So, yeah.
Now, can a city dweller play this grow-your-own-food game, or do we have to wait until we get out into the country?
I would encourage everybody everywhere to start growing some food. And if you're a city dweller, there's lots of options. So, you know, one is try to get into the community garden if you possibly can. In fact, that's one of the best ways because that's where the other experienced people are that can help you get up to speed quicker. I know that a lot of community gardens have waiting lists now. So, and then there are lots of rooftop garden options. That's one thing you want to be careful of, that, you know, you're not putting too much weight up there. So check with the owner of the building. But there are lots and lots of buildings. I saw a statistic recently that there were 44,000 acres of usable with enough sunlight and structurally correct rooftop area in New York City. I was like, wow, they could be growing a ton of food up there. And they're starting to grow some. They got some greenhouses and things going on different building tops. There's, of course, also, the, you know, your patio or your balcony or whatever room you can find. There's also, you know, you can just do some things indoors. There's some really nice little planters that I like that are, you know, maybe only about 3 or 4 square feet. They're not that big, but you can grow probably a half a dozen lettuces or so. And, you know, if you get them, the key thing with that would be to make sure that that soil is really rich with nutrition. You're not going to get a lot of calories out of it, but a lot of people are malnourished. So eating nutrition-rich lettuce might be, you know, it's going to make that nourishment more bioavailable from you and for you, and much, much better than vitamins.
Yeah, we had one fellow in North Vancouver who became an urban farmer by finding people who didn't really want to look after their own backyards, and he took over a whole series of backyards, started doing planting, grew crops that he sold commercially, and made a living out of it.
Well, that was going to be my next suggestion, is there are some websites out there. I think sharedearth.com is one where they're hooking up people that have some land with people that want to do it. And I think that's awesome. You know, there's lots of folks that say, hey, I've got a yard, and if you want a garden, come here and do that and, you know, maybe give me a share or not or whatever, you know. I know Joel Salatin, who is known as America's Farmer, he was like, you don't even need land to farm. You know, there's so much land out there that people would love you to farm on it because they want the agricultural exemption. And they'll lease it to you for a song. So, you know, there's lots about Carol Deppe, probably one of the most astute writers. She's the one who wrote The Resilient Gardener and also Breed Your Own Vegetable Varieties. I mean, this woman is really teaching you how to grow food in preparation for a collapse-type scenario. She has never owned her own land. She's always just, you know, rented a plot from here or there or whatever. And yet she's been growing her own food for 40 years.
So what community options does your own network offer?
Yeah, you know, we are just starting to get some features built up for that. We are looking at setting up a whole marketplace area where people can connect up. You know, it's kind of funny what a request we get all the time that I need to... that we're going to set up for is I get a lot of people who go, hey, Marjorie, you know, I'm a 45-year-old woman and I love to garden and I'm looking for a mate. Yeah, I'm looking for a guy. Even some singles. We're like, I get so many requests for singles. I'm like, you know, we got to get this marketplace and have a single section, but and also a seed swap section, you know, varieties of seeds that you've been saving, as well as another request we get commonly from people is, I've got this beautiful property. I've been growing organic on it for years, and I just want to make sure that who I sell it to is really going to be somebody who, you know, who cares for the earth and is going to treat it that way. And do you have any real estate listing? So I've got my web developer, my IT guy. We're hoping to roll that out actually next month is the marketplace. So I'll, you know, go over to grownetwork.com and sign up for our newsletter, and you'll be the first to know when the marketplace becomes available.
Do you have any other projects you want to tell us about?
I do. We are working on, you know, the overuse of antibiotics is a huge, huge issue. And our population worldwide has become utterly dependent on the use of pharmaceutical antibiotics. And then I think you're well aware of the superbugs. So there's all kinds of bacteria and whatever that, like penicillin was this miracle drug for the first decade or two that it was out. And then now it's essentially useless. And in fact, the bacteria that overcame penicillin have mutated into, I think it's MRSA, and the MRSA bacteria, which is now even more potent and harder and difficult. So more and more, I think the CDC in the United States, the Center for Disease Control, estimates that about 23,000 people a year will die in the United States alone from infections that cannot be treated anymore with antibiotics. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The pharmaceutical companies, I don't know why they're not developing new antibiotics, but they aren't. And there aren't any new antibiotics in the pipeline. Actually, it's probably a good thing because we don't need more antibiotics. But there really is, maybe it may not be profitable. I mean, if you think about it, you spend so much money to develop one of these, and then it's only effective for a decade or two. It may not be worth their while to actually create any of these. I think the bacteria are also mutating faster, you know, real, and the World Health Organization, I mean, some of these organizations I'm not exactly enthralled with, but they are making statements like, this is serious. I think Margaret Chan is the director of the World Health Organization. She said, you know, there's a time when a cut finger on a child may possibly kill that child or a sore throat, or, you know, we're heading into an era where antibiotics don't work anymore. So, personally, I have always done the best I can to avoid antibiotics, the pharmaceutical ones, and over the years I've been using other techniques. Now, you know, people have been getting cut up and wounded and whatever for, like, well, ever since there's been humans, right? I mean, you think of all those movies, those biblical movies in Greece and Rome, and they're fighting each other with those swords and all that stuff, and you know, not all of those guys died just because they had a wound. They had methods of treating people when they got lacerations or infections, and not everybody survived, but they definitely had very effective techniques and ancient ancestral medicine, and it works. When my first boy was about 1 year old, I got mastitis in my breast, which if it weren't treated, that's a lethal thing, right? And we treated it with a poultice of, you know, different cabbage and ginger and things, and used basic poulticing techniques and treated it just fine. I've had massive conjunctivitis in my eye. I've had abscess tooth. My husband was very nervous about that. He said, "Hun, these are infections that are right close to your brain. You need to go." And I'm like, "No, I think we can do this at home." And we did. Most recently, about 2 years ago, I got bit by a copperhead snake when I was out harvesting some tomatoes and just treated the whole thing at home. So there are these really effective techniques, and you don't want to start treating a snake bite right out of the get-go, right? If you want to use this ancestral medicine, you need to start with something small, like, you know, you get a little cut or something like that, right? Or, you know, somebody has a little sprain or there's a minor injury, right? You don't want to start out trying to cure cancer, right? You want to start out with small things and gain your confidence and learn how to use this medicine, start getting more comfortable with it. And wean yourself from the pharmaceutical antibiotics. Here's another fascinating thing. In the U.S., and I'm, you know, to all of our listeners globally, I'm sure you can translate into your own numbers, but there's about 1 million joint replacements a year, and that's only expected to increase because of the, especially the baby boomer population doesn't have such good posture, and I think that's the main reason why we have so many joint problems. The people have just been abusing their joints by walking and sitting in all these crazy positions. But regardless, all those kind of surgeries are going to become riskier and riskier and riskier because pharmaceutical antibiotics are not going to be available. So you are not going to want to go under the knife if, you know, if the possibility of infection is, and then the possibility of not ever being able to treat that infection is an issue, right? So when they talk about the antibiotics apocalypse, they really mean it. And so I met a wonderful healer, and a lot of your local herbalists will know these skills, but I met this wonderful herbalist who's been living on the wilderness for the past 20 years. He comes in to buy stuff and trade for things and all that, and now he's come back because he's really wanting to spend more time. But he has treated all kinds of things. You know, he runs into hikers out there that have sprained their legs or broken their arm or whatever, and he treats them with just plants and things that are out there, and very effectively. And I dug is where I learned a lot of the medicine that I've learned. And I said, Doug, we're gonna make a video about this, about how to treat infection. So we did. We've created a product, and it'll teach you. It's mostly about external infections, so you know, snake bites, spider bites, lacerations, you know, like a sprained ankle or a you know, broken bone. Those kind of infections, you know, if you're getting any kind of cut and you're seeing those red streaks, this would be medicine to treat it. And it's effective. I mean, I've been using it for years, and I really feel that we need to go back to that.
Well, and I think, too, if we can return to the grow-your-own-food aspect, if we build up our immune systems by having all those microchemicals and small little things that our body needs to really be whole. And I think that my own health has improved a lot since I'm eating out of my garden instead of the grocery store.
Yeah. Malnutrition is the elephant in the room, right? We say, you think of malnutrition and your average person in North America is going to think, oh, those poor, you know, Africans, and right? No. Most of North America is malnourished. You know, your average American is malnourished. Your average Mexican, oh my God, the Mexicans are like way worse than the Americans in terms of obesity and diabetes and all these diseases that have to do with consumption of this really terrible food supply that we have. You're absolutely right, getting the right nutrients, because it's just not in the commercial food supply.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there, Marjorie. I've so much enjoyed talking with you again. And just for those who have tuned in, we've been talking with Texas homesteader, prepper, and skills teacher Marjorie Wildcraft. I've watched her Grow Your Own Groceries DVD, and I'm applying some of those tips around my home and garden. You can start with Marjorie's excellent YouTube videos and connect with others on the resilience path through thegrownetwork.org, thegrownetwork.org. Marjorie, thanks so much. It's been really a treat to talk with you again.
Alex, I sure appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Life on Earth is full of surprises. One peaceful day, 66 million years ago, in a climate quite like our own, an asteroid crashed into what we now call the Gulf of Mexico. Nothing has been the same since. New science published this summer in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has shed light on this mysterious catastrophe. To see what we can learn, I've reached the lead author, Dr. Charles G. Bardeen. He's a project scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Charles, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I think this paper contains a lot of useful science about our atmosphere and unexpected climate detours. Charles, what hit the Earth millions of years ago?
Well, what we've seen in the ocean is a crater that's about 100 kilometers in diameter, and that suggests an asteroid of about 10 kilometers in diameter. And it was likely composed of a rocky material, but it could have been iron.
And we have no idea where it came from. I mean, it just came from space one day.
Correct.
And what happened in the first couple of days after it hit?
So when it first hit, it would have created very high pressures at the surface that would have vaporized both the asteroid itself and the material at the surface. So you would have had vaporized rock. You would have created gases like CO2 and water vapor. Some of this, you would also have pulverized rock from the impact. So you would have had rock debris and water being splashed over large areas, as well as going up into the atmosphere. The vaporized material would travel all around the Earth, and as it comes back in, it would have cooled and formed particles that we call spherules that we can see in the sedimentary record. These small rocky particles, as they enter the atmosphere, would have gotten very hot, and that heat would have broiled animals that were at the surface and would have started large wildfires, global or near global scale wildfires. And those wildfires would have put soot into the atmosphere, high up into the atmosphere. The impact of the asteroid would also have triggered tsunamis, large waves propagating away from the origin of the impact. It could have also triggered earthquakes and could have triggered volcanic eruptions, and the volcanic eruptions could have put more gases into the atmosphere.
So what tools did you use to estimate the rapid changes to the atmosphere in such a short period, many millions of years ago?
So the main tool that we used is a climate model, the Community Earth System Model, which is a model here at NCAR. That's a model that we use to study climate change, and we adapted that model to handle the large changes that came along with this event.
And so you got some of the input from geologic changes that we can actually find in the record of the rocks.
That's correct. So the main thing that we wanted to include in the model was the soot from the forest fires, because that's a particle that is very strongly absorbing. And of the things that might have been injected into the atmosphere, like the sulfate aerosols or dust, the soot would have had the strongest effect. And that is something that we have an estimate from the sedimentary record. So our colleagues, Wolbach and all, they dug into the sediments dated back to that time period and did microscopic analysis to look at how much soot was in that layer and estimated the size of the particles that were in that layer. And some of these particles were very small sized that could have stayed in the atmosphere for a prolonged period. And so those were the particles that it was important for us to include in our model. And they had estimates ranging from 15,000 to 30,000 teragrams.
Which is just a gigantic amount of carbon and soot. I mean, it's unimaginable how much went up there.
That's correct.
And that darkened the sun.
It did. And because soot is very absorbing of sunlight, that heated the atmosphere where that soot was located and caused that soot to rise up into the stratosphere. And that's a part of the atmosphere that is outside of our normal weather. And so particles there can remain for a long period of time before they fall out. And so that's what we wanted to do in our model, was to see how long that would last, what effect that would have on both the surface and the chemistry in the upper atmosphere.
Were plants able to survive down on the Earth's surface during the period that soot was up there?
Plants on land would likely have been burned by the global fires, and then the darkness was sufficient to stop photosynthesis. So it's unlikely that plants would have regrown quickly from seed or from root if they had survived the fires. Likewise, in the ocean, without any sunlight, plants aren't going to grow, and so phytoplankton would have suffered, and that would have been catastrophic for the food chain in the ocean.
So how long did the Earth stay in that darkness before photosynthesis could start up again?
Our estimates are just under 2 years, about 18 months, 19 months.
Wow. Okay, so this asteroid hit is classified then as a mass extinction event, I presume?
Yes, this is one of the five mass extinction events, and it's the one that's most recent historically, so that's the one that we have the most evidence about.
So tell us about the changes to the ozone layer after this asteroid struck and about the ultraviolet rays.
So because this soot went into the stratosphere, that's where our protective ozone layer resides. It heated up the stratosphere, and that heating caused an increase in a chemical reaction that destroys ozone. In addition, the tropopause, the boundary between the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, and the stratosphere, got warm, and water that normally would not go into the stratosphere ended up making it into the stratosphere, making the stratosphere very wet, and that created more what we call HOX, which has a catalytic reaction that also destroys ozone. So there were two mechanisms to destroy ozone, and so ozone levels got very low, equivalent to a global ozone hole. However, this didn't cause immediate problems at the surface in terms of UV radiation because we also had the soot in the atmosphere at the same time. So while we weren't protected at the surface from UV by ozone, we were protected at the surface by soot. But as that soot fell out, it took longer for the ozone to recover. And so there was a period of about 2 years where we experienced very high ultraviolet at the surface, and that would have lasted for about 2 years and would have been about three times the normal amount of UV radiation at the surface. And there was a paper by a colleague, Betty Piarazzo, who used this type of model looking at an ocean impact of a 1 kilometer asteroid. And then we did a 1 kilometer impact on land. You don't get enough soot there to block photosynthesis, but you do get cooling about 4 Kelvin in the case of the 1 kilometer impact on land. And then you get much more extreme UV from both of those cases because you don't have as much soot blocking, or in the water impact, you don't have soot at all, but you still destroy the ozone.
Did I hear that the stratosphere is getting wetter now or is cooling now? What's the status of it?
Yeah, so global warming implies that you also have a cooling in the stratosphere.
Why?
The CO2 that goes into the atmosphere is a greenhouse gas, so it traps radiation at the surface, but it also in the upper atmosphere radiates to space, so it can cool the upper atmosphere.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, you've also studied the effects of volcanic activity on the upper atmosphere. Have volcanic emissions been steady over the last 100 years?
I personally haven't actually done studies with volcanoes, but volcanoes are a variable source of sulfates into the, or SO2 into the atmosphere that form sulfate aerosols. So you have periods with big eruptions. And then recently we've had periods where we haven't had large eruptions, but we have had small eruptions that have put significant amounts of SO2 into the atmosphere.
So in a way, this latest paper that we're talking about is a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is that when almost everything above water burned in a fireball and the sun went out for a couple of years, life did survive and it came back to thrive, although different forms of life. But the bad news is that an asteroid could strike Earth again. I know the moon and many planets are pockmarked with strikes from outer space. Isn't it always possible we could get hit again?
It is possible. And so NASA has a program to try to monitor for that, to look for some of these big asteroids and understand what their trajectories are. And so we don't know of any that would intersect with the Earth. We had one called Florence that just went by a few days ago that is about half the size of what we think hit in the Yucatan. And half the size means eighth of the energy. So that wouldn't have been sufficient to have caused global fires and the same amount of destruction, extinction that we saw in our simulations.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Charles Bardeen, the atmospheric scientist from the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. Your work reminds me of other science about massive dust after nuclear war. Do you think there's a relationship or lessons to be learned there?
Yeah, the same kind of modeling framework that we used for this study has also been used to look at what might happen after a nuclear war. And it's the fires from the nuclear war that would put soot into the atmosphere, just like the asteroid would put soot into the atmosphere. The amounts of soot would be far less. So one study looked at a regional nuclear war, say like an India-Pakistan type of exchange, and that's 5 teragrams of soot. But it still had global consequences, not to the extent that we saw in our study. The surface cooling there was more like 1 degree instead of 15 degrees of cooling, and it wouldn't have put enough soot in the atmosphere to block photosynthesis. but it could have affected the length of growing seasons and caused famine and other serious problems. There's also been studies that have looked at larger amounts, between 50 and 150 teragrams of soot that you might get from a global nuclear war. So that would be something like a U.S.-Russia event. And there you would get a cooling of about 4 degrees to maybe 8 degrees for the 150 teragram event. And so those would have increased stress on our ability to grow food.
Now, it's my limited understanding, I'm not a scientist, that the weather happens in the troposphere lower down and doesn't really affect the stratosphere. But I'm wondering, I mean, Hurricane Irma was so large it shook the Earth. It showed up on seismic monitors. Can a major weather system influence the stratosphere, or is there a limit to that near-term weather disturbance?
Yes, weather can affect the upper atmosphere. Large fires can put soot into the stratosphere. Something like one of these hurricanes can put water vapor into the upper atmosphere and can also cause dynamical disturbances in the upper atmosphere.
So what got you into studying the mysteries of the atmosphere?
Well, I was a software engineer for about 20 years and decided I wanted a new challenge that was more rewarding and went back to school and got my PhD and got involved in climate modeling. This project was one of those interesting events to study.
Where do you see your research going next?
Well, we're interested in taking this back to the Cretaceous time period. So the model that we used was set up for present-day conditions because it takes more work to get a model set up for the Cretaceous. You have to run the ocean for hundreds or a thousand years to get it initialized to those conditions. But I have colleagues that I'm working with who have such a model, and we're going to combine these together so that we can get a more accurate understanding of what would have happened in various locales. So where people have fossil records, we can get a better estimate of what the temperatures would have been like in those areas. And then I'm also going to be getting involved in some nuclear winter studies where we're going to use this type of a model to understand both the small-scale regional wars and the large-scale wars and trying to understand what those impacts could be so we can inform policymakers of the risks involved.
I'll be looking forward to that work. From the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, we've been talking with atmospheric scientist Charles G. Bardeen. He's the lead author of a new paper in PNAS titled On Transient Climate Change at the Cretaceous-Paleogene Boundary Due to Atmospheric Soot Injections. You can find helpful links about this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Charles, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith. We hear warnings from expert scientists, and then there's this. The invaluable Peter Sinclair caught up with Danish ice scientist Jorgen Peter Stephensen and posted a 5-minute video. You need to hear it.
The last 11,000 years, that's since the Ice Age, this our interglacial period has been unreasonably stable. And we don't know why. With an enhanced greenhouse effect from burning of fossil fuel, CO2 and methane and so on, you would have a gradual increase in temperature. That's what all the models show you. It's sort of a gradual increase in temperature. But that's assuming that the climate plays nice. And we actually know from the ice cores that the climate does not play nice all the time. Right now, by emitting greenhouse gases, we are doing the same with the climate system as the investment banks in the U.S. did when they were selling subprime loans in the economy in 2006 and 7. In the last million years, there's been a cycle of approximately 10 ice ages. And they were sort of around 90,000 years long, each of them. And then there was an interglacial period separating the ice ages of about 10,000 years. That's sort of the standard rule of events in the last million years. If we then zoom in on an ice age, you see that inside an ice age, the climate is extremely unstable. And you have this sequence of abrupt climate changes that happen basically from one year to the next. And it swings from semi-cold to very cold, semi-cold to very cold, within very short spaces of time. But each of these cycles is about a couple of thousand years long. And we had that 26 times in the last ice age. all the big cultures in India, China, Mesopotamia, Egypt, South America, all came after the Ice Age. So we are assuming that this is the standard. Our collective memory refers to this as this is normal. And maybe by enhancing our emissions of greenhouse gases, we are actually tipping the climate system to become yet unstable again as it used to be. We can face a climate change that happens just as sudden as a financial crisis. We have tons of examples of climate changes where we see complete reorganization of the atmospheric circulation from one year to the next. And that will be extremely hurtful for any agricultural activity in the world because the weather will change and will not change back. Fast climate transitions, these abrupt climate changes that we see recorded in the Ice Age, they were discovered in the Greenland Ice Cores. But now they keep finding them everywhere in the marine sediments, wherever they look. But when it comes to Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, you don't see them. What you see there, it's also a wiggly climate line, but opposite. So when it's warm in Greenland, Antarctica cools off. And when it's cold in Greenland, Antarctica warms up. So these abrupt climate changes, it's an internal oscillation in the Earth climate system. What if what we do now is introducing so much fresh water into the North Atlantic that the North Atlantic current would sort of stop? That would make it terribly cold in Denmark, where I come from, because we are, all of Northern Europe is placed at completely unreasonable latitudes. Just because of we have the North Atlantic current, we have remote heating, so to say. If that's going to be switched off, we are getting very, very cold. But still, the Earth could get warmer on average. It's just a distribution problem now. In principle, there's no reason why the Earth could not get warmer, but still Northern Europe and North America could get cold. Still, that area is not large compared to the global area. What we know from the sudden climate changes in the past is that these abrupt changes represent a reconfiguration of the entire atmospheric pattern. What if, with the emission of greenhouse gases, that we trigger a situation when this system all of a sudden goes into a feedback? If you reconfigure the transport patterns of high pressures and low pressure systems over North America and, for instance, Europe, but particularly North America and the Midwest, and all of a sudden it stops to rain, and it hits the Midwest and the U.S., and it leads to massive crop failure, that's going to impact the entire world. We don't know. We don't know where the threshold is. But we are rats inside the experiment.
That was Jorgen Peder Steffensen, recorded by Peter Sinclair, the founder of ClimateCrocs.com. The title is Inside the Experiment: The Climate Does Not Always Play Nice. It was published October 3rd. Find a link to the video in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Thank you, Peter, for your dedication. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and letting yourself into the awful truth. Let's keep trying.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
I think that asserting your identity through your work and telling your own stories is the most important thing you can do for yourself.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we're thrilled to present this in-depth conversation about art, identity, politics, and expression between graphic novelist Yasmin Omar Atta and the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Marguerite Dubai. Read Dubai's recent review of Atta's book, Mishadra, on electronicintifada.net, titled Visualizing a Feeling. And now, here's Marguerite Dubai interviewing Yasmin Omar Atta.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. My name is Marguerite Dubai, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm here today with artist Yasmin Omar Atta. Yasmin is a Middle Eastern comics artist, game designer, illustrator, and curator who creates art about coping with illness, understanding identity, dismantling oppressive structures, and Islamic futurism. Their work includes contributing art to the games Four Horsemen and Ghosts of Miami, as well as creating the game Being, the comic Zenith, and their upcoming graphic novel, Mishadra, which will be released by Gallery 13 in October. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all. I wanted to, I read Mishadra, and I wanted to start with asking you, well, first I'll say primarily that a basic plot line for Mishadra is that it's the protagonist, Isaac, is this person who is dealing with having epilepsy and is clearly just trying to have this very normal college life. And he's, just trying to, figure out how to navigate this and having all of these social structures stacked against him and having, people, misunderstanding him, having this disease and things like that. So I wanted to ask you first, what made you decide to write this particular comic? writes this particular comic about epilepsy in particular.
So I get this question a lot, and it's funny because usually when you write something like this, there's like multiple influences and things like that. And like, I was going through a lot at the time because I had just been diagnosed with epilepsy about like a year, year and a half before I started writing. So it was still kind of new and I was still like really struggling with it. And around the time where I started writing the comic, which is about fall 2013, I was in my senior year of school at SVA, and we had to do a portfolio project. I was trying to think of what to do, and I had some ideas, and I kind of wanted to do something with epilepsy because I had done my thesis the year before about Charles V, who was a Holy Roman Emperor who had epilepsy as well. So that was on my mind, and I really, you know, enjoyed slash, like, had a cathartic release with my thesis comic. And so I kind of had some ideas rolling around, but the main thing, the one event that pointed me to do this comic was I was going to meet up with some friends in Manhattan around this time, and I started having a episode of CPSC, which is Complex Partial Status Epilepticus, a mouthful. But basically, it's a different kind of seizure that's non-convulsive, and you stay in like a dreamlike state. You have problems navigating. Some people kind of equated it to sort of like having a strange, like, lucid dream or high, or having a really intense anxiety attack, things like that. So I started getting that, and I was in the middle of Manhattan, and I was like, oh my God, like, I gotta get home. So I'm trying to, like, figure out how to get home, and, like, I've lived here for a while. I know Manhattan. It's kind of hard to get lost there, but, like, I kept getting turned around, and finally I see a subway station across the street. I'm like, okay, finally. And I start to walk towards it, and I step right in front of a bus. Like, that's, like, careening down the street. And it literally missed me. I can't even, like, by half an inch, like, right in front of my face. And I was stunned. I was like, I could have died. Like, I was literally staring at the road, just being like, I could have completely just died because of this seizure, basically. Right. And that was the point where I was like, okay, I think people need to know about this.
Yeah.
So it's, I have that. Things were swirling around that one event, but that one day was, like, the day where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And that's when I decided to make sort of a, I wouldn't say non-traditional, but sort of a more amorphous story structure, where it's a story that is following a bunch of different events about things that happened to me. So I kind of compiled a lot of stuff that happened to me into, like, a linear thread.
Okay. It actually, because it's interesting because you mentioned this particular seizure that's a dreamlike state. You do actually mention this in the comic, and it's something that I certainly wouldn't know about, was really, I mean, I'm glad to know about it now, honestly, that there are these different kinds of seizures, and there are these experiences that, you know, Isaac has, and by extension, other people who have epilepsy have. And so, and it clearly is heavily connected to you and your own experiences. And I think that really reads into the work really, really well. And, like, really, it's really evident. How can I say this? It's really, like, visceral.
Yeah, it comes across.
It's very visceral work. It's very intense work.
It's, you know, it's funny because, you know, it was a webcomic before, and now it's coming out as a book. And now that, like, oh, the book's going to come out in October, and it's kind of, people are starting to read the advanced copies or whatever, I've seen some people tagging it as, like, own voices and things like that. And to me, I'm glad, because that makes a lot of sense. It's like, it wouldn't be what it is, and it wouldn't come across as much as it does if I didn't have epilepsy. I would just be writing somebody else's story.
Right.
I mean, people have asked me in the past, you know, have you read David B's Epileptic, you know, et cetera? And I'm like, you know, I read parts of it, and I liked it, but that's, you know, someone who doesn't have that, like, telling their, like, observational story about it. And that's totally cool. The comic has its place or whatever, but, like, there does need to be more of an extension of, like, you have your story and tell it from your perspective as opposed to someone telling it for you.
Right. Totally understandable. So another question I have is that, so something I also find interesting about the comic is that it has this wide appeal to it. You know, it's sort of incidentally informational. You know, it's not just a comic, it's just, like, simply just, like, doling out information, like, this is the warning signs of epilepsy. You know, like, it it does it in this very humanistic way, very personal way. We learn about Isaac's life and you know, it makes it much more relatable and things like that. So what I'm wondering is, like, do you feel that primarily Michel Bravo is meant to, like, comfort people who are who have epilepsy, or is it meant to inform people who don't have epilepsy?
It's kind of both, mm-hmm. in a way. It's hard to say which or the other, because for me, when I first started doing it, you know, since it came from a place of people need to know about this, like I said, it came from a place of, like, I want to tell people about it. So it started kind of from there, but as I started drawing it, I realized that, like, someone sitting there and telling you, I'm afraid, or I'm scared, or I'm having this thing, just straight up saying it to your face, it's good to have that, but at the same time, it's not as effective as trying to suture somebody into sort of, like, I use a lot of non-literal mm-hmm. visuals in the comic, and the yeah. reason for that is so it can get to somebody viscerally without someone having to sit you down and tell you in very, like, mechanical detail, right. Spelling out their emotions or their feelings or whatever their physical experience is. So I started doing that in order to, like, bring the information across better, but as I started doing that, around, like, page 40 or something like that, like, I started to get really cathartic. Like, it started to really bring out a lot of stuff in me and really started to help me work through it. Mm-hmm. Like, I definitely wouldn't be as functional as I am right now if I didn't have this comic, and that's, like, the honest to God truth.
That's awesome. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So, it's funny. It's kind of both. I want people who don't know about epilepsy to learn from it, like, informational-wise, like, okay, this is what happens, the kind of step-to-step, and someone I know might be feeling this way, but I also want them to get, like, not necessarily comfort, but an emotional understanding of, like, oh, I know somebody with this condition, and this is what they go through, mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of an insight. Like, I've had people come to me and be like, my dad has epilepsy, you know, my friend has epilepsy, I know somebody, and this comic, like, help me understand them better, and that really means a lot to me. Like, I save all those messages because mm-hmm. they mean the world to me. And so I don't know if I could say one or the other, information or comfort. I would say whatever you need to get from this comic, I want you to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's both and neither and everything.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, and what you're saying kind of goes hand in hand with the comic. I mean, there's a very, like, introspective element to the comic. I felt like it was very dreamlike. And I think not only because of, not to give too much away, but, like, but
spoilers.
No spoilers here. But, you know, like, the sort of, the visuals that you chose to use, that aren't just, you know, they're not literal visuals. They're very imaginative visuals that you chose to use. And, you know, there are dream sequences with Isaac where he's just sort of very introspective in these scenes. And it's a very thoughtful comic, and just, like, sort of, like, his internal struggle.
Right.
Just dealing with it. So
there's not a whole lot of action.
No, there's
like, this is not One Piece. Like,
no, it's not One Piece.
It's funny, because sometimes people are like, what is the comic about? And I'm like, it's about epilepsy and dealing with it, and that's not really, like, sometimes it's kind of hard for people to get into, so I'm glad whenever people, it's like, you're saying, oh, like, it's very introspective and dreamlike, and I enjoy that, I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, good. You know, it's not really yeah. a very, it's very amorphous in a way.
It is amorphous. I think it's a good description. So, you know, and another thing is that there's sort of a nod to your Palestinian heritage mm-hmm. to the work. That he knows, you know, there's a little bit, he talks to his dad on the phone, he's using, you know, talking a little bit of Arabic, his dad is literally Baba on the phone. You know, there's a little bit. He has a very Arabic last name and that
yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm just glad that someone's like, it's Baba on his phone. Like, that's how my dad's on my phone, so.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm really glad whenever someone catches on.
Yes. Yes.
I definitely integrated that, but it kind of comes through in all of my work. But it's interesting because Mishadra, like, because it's gone on so long, I started it, you know, 4 years ago. So it really actually yeah. is, like, my first big work, and I made an active decision to include just basic bits of daily life, like, you know, talking a little bit in Arabic and, like, mm-hmm. having, you know, like, again, like, Muda, last name, things like that, just kind of these little day-to-day details.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the focus of the story is not the fact that he is partially Palestinian, partially Arab. Like,
right.
The comic is not about that. And I think in a lot of works, there tends to be, like, a push for it to be about that. I'm like, no, this character is just this person with this background, and they're going through a thing. It, like, doesn't have to focus on that. You know, so, like, I think it's important to insert characters who are their identity, but just going through a thing. Because there's, like, this this idea that you have to, like, hyper-specialize on that if that's present. You know what I mean?
No, I totally understand that. That it's sort of, it definitely, it felt sort of like a background thing. Just sort of like, that's kind of cool kind of thing. But it definitely wasn't like this red light, Palestinian, you know. And
it's not about racism. It's not about the Palestinian experience. I make other stuff about that. This comic is like, this is a person,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they have their culture and everything is integrated into their daily life. And that's that, you know. So it's there and it's present, but the story is not about that.
Right, totally. I actually would like to talk about your video game being, because because I did play it and I found it to be amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you.
No, I really loved it. And I found it to be, by the way, if you are listening, you can actually download it. You can actually purchase it and download it. There will be a link available, so you can go to Yasmin's website and download it, etc.
Thank you. I hope you're listening.
but the game, it's just, you know, I found it to be just extremely harrowing and, you know, just alludes it. So the game, to reiterate, the game, it's how can I explain it?
It's like a short, it probably wouldn't take anyone more than half an hour, an hour. A short RPG Maker abstract adventure game that basically implies that someone from the future of Palestine comes back to the old land and the old cities in Palestine and is trying to find artifacts and learn about what happened there. And through that, I try to tell my experience being Palestinian and various parts of the Palestinian book experience.
Yes. No, that's perfect.
It's kind of weird. It's kind of a strange thing, because, like, you wouldn't really equate, like, RPG Maker games with telling someone's, like, personal experience with their culture and their race and, like, the politics of that. But it just, that's what I wanted to do.
I thought it was great.
Thank you.
I'm a big gamer myself, and so I personally really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I mean, the game definitely alludes to these universal experiences of Palestinians. Like, I mean, I found an allusion to, like, the Nakba, the, you know, like, colonialism and, like, just general Palestinian othering and Arab othering. But it doesn't really lay out this information in cold facts. It just sort of similar to Mishapra, it's sort of like this background information, you know, without just, like, and then, you know, the Gaza war happened, you know.
There's no timeline.
So, with that in mind, like, who do you think is the intended audience for being? Like, is it, is the best scenario people who know nothing about what's happening in Palestine, or is it people who have some general information about what's going on?
It's really, honestly, anybody who's interested in playing. I designed the game so there's actually not a whole lot of what people would consider quote-unquote gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, the gameplay is focused around anybody can play. Somebody who has never played a game can pick up this game. All that you need to press are the directional buttons and the A button, and that's it. So I designed it around that so it would be accessible. Anybody who is interested even in the slightest bit of Palestinian lived experience, that game, like, that's the intended audience. And if someone has no idea about the timeline or the facts or anything,
and they play this game and they're interested, I'm like, go look it up. You know, you have Google or whatever.
Right,
like
right.
You have, or if there's a library, you have some ability to find out the facts without me having to spell them out to you, because that's not my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that person can still come to the game and be like, oh, you know, you have like the emotional information someone's giving you, and if that's enough for you to go and look up the like physical facts, then that's great. Like, mm-hmm. I'm glad that you're taking that away from it. At the same time, I do want people who have some information or even some bias against Palestine to play this game and,
right.
and see what they get from it and try to basically insert them into this experience.
Right.
And try to make that come across. And ultimately, the people who are Palestinian and have played it and, you know, really feel something for it, like when you're telling me, like, oh, it was harrowing and I loved it, that is a huge deal to me, too. So basically everybody, in so many words, like anybody who has any sort of interest in Palestinian lived experience. I'm like, please, if you want to play this game, please play this game. And for me, I always want to know what people got from it.
Okay.
You know.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Swanson, campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org, who talks about what's at stake for the U.S. and the world in President Trump's move to decertify the International Iran Nuclear Weapons Agreement. Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer, who discusses the status of post-Hurricane Maria relief efforts in Puerto Rico and mounting anger at the federal government for its slow and disorganized response. And activists Susan Dantino and Erica Raghavan Byrne, who explain why they oppose and protested a newly dedicated memorial honoring Christopher Columbus in Southington, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time in 3 years, the Palestinian government, led by President Mahmoud Abbas, met in Gaza to settle the differences between Hamas and Fatah, whose leadership has been bitterly divided for a decade. The meeting, backed by Egypt and Saudi Arabia, was seen as a milestone for Palestinian unity. In recent months, the Abbas government has put increased pressure on Hamas in Gaza by rationing electric power to the territory. Hamas also faced reduced support from Qatar, a nation who is now the target of Saudi-led sanctions. Poverty and unemployment have been on the rise for some time in isolated Gaza. Security negotiations will begin soon in Cairo, which will include a discussion of opening the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, which was closed in 2013. Negotiations will also focus on the future status of Hamas's 20,000-member militia, the Qassam Brigades. Hamas is blacklisted as a terrorist organization by the United States and the EU, complicating the formation of any unity government. ProPublica reports Texas first responders were disappointed with the performance of the American Red Cross in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. With less than a day's notice, the DeWitt County school superintendent was forced to run an emergency shelter in an unused district building to house 400 people. For the first 3 days that the shelter was open, only 2 Red Cross volunteers were assigned, and neither had any experience running a shelter. The American Red Cross has been on the receiving end of severe criticism for its response to recent natural disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, where the organization was found to have diverted funds into a public relations self-promotion campaign. The Red Cross has a unique role among humanitarian groups, since it has a government mandate to provide food and shelter during disasters. Despite criticism from Greater Houston officials, The Red Cross defends its response to Hurricane Harvey, declaring that it provided more than 400,000 emergency overnight shelter stays and served over 3 million meals. Houston City Councilor Dave Martin called the Red Cross the, quote, most inept, unorganized organization I've ever experienced. This came days after Martin ran into American Red Cross CEO Gail McGovern, who bragged about raising $2 billion after Hurricane Katrina and lamented that her organization would likely raise comparatively very little money after Harvey. Right-wing California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher met with Putin-linked Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya during an April 2016 trip to Moscow. This development emerged as special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation indicates increased interest in a later meeting between Veselnitskaya, Donald Trump Jr., the president's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and former campaign chairman Paul Manafort in Trump Tower. During her meeting with Rohrabacher, the Russian lawyer gave Rohrabacher a copy of a documentary attacking the credibility of U.S. sanctions under the Magnitsky Act, which the congressman unsuccessfully attempted to screen before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The Russian lawyer told a pro-Kremlin news outlet about her meeting with Rohrabacher, a key advocate of improved U.S.-Russian relations. The meeting focused on the Magnitsky Act, which sanctions individual Russians who were implicated in the death of a Russian lawyer who had been investigating the theft of $230 million from an American company owned by financier Bill Browder. A spokesman for Rohrabacher confirmed the meeting with Veselnitskaya during a congressional trip to Moscow. 3 months later, in the midst of the presidential campaign, the Kremlin-connected lawyer met with Donald Trump Jr., Kushner, and Manafort in New York, who had been led to believe that Veselnitskaya would hand over embarrassing information about Hillary Clinton. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Through his own words during the presidential campaign, and more recent remarks before the United Nations, Donald Trump is expected to take steps that could kill the international nuclear agreement with Iran, that some observers assert is the most important nuclear anti-proliferation pact this century. Trump has indicated he will decertify the agreement that President Obama and five other world powers negotiated with Iran in 2015. The deal, strongly opposed by Republicans, conservatives, and Israel, suspended Iran's nuclear weapons program and in return lifted internationally observed economic sanctions. If Trump decertifies the agreement, the issue moves to Congress, which opens a 60-day period for debate. If Congress votes to reimpose sanctions against Iran, it would effectively withdraw the U.S. from the nuclear agreement. While Trump says Iran violates the spirit of the agreement, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency maintains that Iran is in compliance, a determination shared by the other signatories to the deal, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany. Trump's Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have both indicated they support maintaining the agreement with Iran. Your reporter spoke with author and journalist David Swanson, who serves as campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org. Here he talks about his group's current campaign, opposing any congressional move to kill the International Iran Nuclear Weapons Agreement, and what's at stake if the agreement is terminated.
If you look for a consensus among those in power, even within the Trump administration, as well as the Congress, as well as the major media outlets and the academic political talking heads, I mean, there's a widespread consensus among U.S. nationalists that it's a good deal and should be stuck with and is one of the few things that's gone right in recent years, and there's no reason to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But Trump apparently thinks that the national interest is whatever suits him personally, and that's a problem. But it's not clear what he's trying to do, because as you say, he's passing this to Congress. He's chosen not to refrain from waivers that he had to renew, that if he had not, would have created new sanctions in the form of renewing old sanctions on Iran. Rather, he's chosen to, as everyone is predicting, by the deadline of October 15th, announce that he decertifies the agreement. This is, of course, after months of the White House very openly seeking to find some way to claim that Iran was violating the agreement. And in the absence of that, Trump is simply going to announce that it's decertified. But that doesn't really change anything other than rhetoric. Congress, as you say, then has to decide whether it wants to impose new sanctions. From the point of view of people in Iran, the United States is, already failing to live up to its side of the bargain in terms of sanction relief. The question is whether yet more sanctions are going to be imposed, and whether this sort of rhetoric, substantive new sanctions, or other steps that have been announced, including Trump's intention to declare the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian military, a terrorist organization, whether any of these things successfully provoke Iran to withdraw from the agreement or provoke Iran into launching a war, both of which seem to be the intention of numerous parties in Washington, D.C.
What's the motive here, do you think? Is this just a hollow campaign commitment that Trump made while he was speaking before adoring crowds during the election campaign, that he was going to get rid of this quote-unquote embarrassing deal, this embarrassing agreement with Iran? Is this really what we're dealing with on that level?
I think that's a big part of it. And certainly the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, with whom Trump has now started a public insult match, believes that Trump is still living in a reality TV show. And he appears to be. And the fact that the United States Congress recognizes that and has not impeached him and removed him from office is extremely disturbing, at least to me, and I think it should be to everyone. But there are people in the Pentagon, high-level officials, who talk fairly openly, if anonymously, to journalists these days about the Cold War with Russia being motivated by weapons sales and by bureaucratic inertia and the future of NATO and the future of the army. And if you look at Iran, the one thing that Iran is in the United States is incredible war propaganda. I mean, it's better than Russia. It's better than ISIS. A couple of years ago, Gallup did a poll, December 2013, in 65 nations. And in the vast majority of them, the answer to what is the greatest threat to peace on earth was the United States government. But in the United States, the answer was Iran. That is of high value to the biggest industry in Washington, D.C., and that is weapons making.
And David, looking down the road, if the Republican-controlled Congress does impose new sanctions on Iran and abrogates the U.S. Part in this nuclear weapons treaty, what is the danger for future tension and conflict between the United States and Iran?
The real danger, of course, is of war. And we're dealing with a White House that has a clear interest in war, is increasingly threatening war, even nuclear war, on North Korea, as well as Iran, as well as Venezuela and other parts of the world. And North Korea has nuclear weapons. Iran does not. And this, you know, the lesson that the world is going to learn is going to be disastrous if the United States attacks another country that has, you know, very publicly disarmed itself of any nuclear weapons, as was the case with Libya. But this is going to be a war to make Iraq and Afghanistan look like child's play. This is going to be horrific if the United States attacks Iran.
That was author and journalist David Swanson, who serves as the campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org. Learn more about the effort to preserve the International Iran Nuclear Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Puerto Rico suffered the most damage from hurricanes this season than the island has witnessed in almost 100 years. Nearly 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, the island is struggling to recover. As of October 10th, 85% of Puerto Ricans are still without electricity. More than 40% don't have running water, and some 80% of cell phone service is out of commission. By some estimates, it may take 6 months or more to restore power and other basic services. The death toll in Puerto Rico attributed to Hurricane Maria has risen to 43, but officials say that number is likely to rise. Islanders continue to fall victim to storm-related hazards, including infections, dangerous road conditions, and lack of emergency medical care. The Trump administration has been condemned for its slow and disorganized response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and now Trump faces more criticism for allowing a temporary waiver of the Jones Act to expire. Without a waiver of the Jones Act that permits only U.S.-flagged ships to carry goods to American ports, Puerto Ricans will continue to face shortages of critical goods urgently needed for storm relief and recovery. Your reporter spoke with Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer. Reached by spotty phone connection on the island, here she discusses the post-Hurricane Maria reality, the status of relief efforts, and the political impact of the disaster on the Puerto Rican people.
The metropolitan area of San Juan, which the U.S. and international media tend to focus on, is on a completely different plane than the rest of the island. Communications are a lot more functional there. Provisions and aid have either reached communities or aren't as urgent as in towns outside of the metropolitan area. Fuels and supplies, supplies attainment have reached levels closer to normalization. And overall, aid and relief have been made more available there, which speaks volumes about the metropolitan area and colonial intra-island dynamics. But for example, the central part of the island and the west side of the island, which is where I am currently, have been abandoned by both the central and federal government. It wasn't until recently that it was declared a disaster zone and therefore qualified for individual disaster assistance. And many communities are worried to the point of utter despair because no aid or relief has reached them yet, because they haven't seen any FEMA representatives, because they have no roof over their heads and FEMA hasn't delivered the tarps. People are rummaging through trash cans, walking miles to springs, creeks and rivers to bathe, to get water to drink, to take care of basic necessities. The situation is dire here.
There's been quite a bit of discussion since the mayor of San Juan had been very publicly critical of FEMA and the federal government's response to the hurricane disaster in Puerto Rico. From your understanding, what has been the weaknesses in FEMA's response and the other agencies of government, as well as the military, which has participated in relief efforts as well?
FEMA has been complaining a lot that roads haven't been cleared yet, while news reporters have been saying that roads have been cleared. And I'm not sure what difference that should make to FEMA, because with double helix helicopters specifically engineered to carry exorbitant amounts, why are they resorting to block roads as an excuse? I mean, the federal government can send helicopters and planes halfway across the world or further to the remotest parts of the planet to make drop-offs and deliver supplies to their military-occupying nations to advance the U.S.'s hegemony, but they can't tend to the humanitarian crisis on the island that JetBlue flies to and from 100 times a day because the roads are blocked. I mean, that just makes no sense to me. I'm not buying it, and many of us aren't. There have been a lot of problems with distribution efforts, and I think that has a lot to do with the state of emergency that was declared here.
with bureaucratic holdups, with the Jones Act, the army here, the military in Puerto Rico, people from different communities and different sectors haven't been receiving any aid from them. It's more of a military occupation in a colonial sense.
I'm wondering what your neighbors think about the federal response in regard to the feeling of some in Puerto Rico that they perceive themselves as second-class citizens in the eyes of Washington. Is that something you've encountered?
Absolutely, and not just here in Puerto Rico, but stateside as well. Our diaspora feels the same exact way. We felt abandoned, and especially in non-metropolitan towns and municipalities in Puerto Rico. Absolutely.
How will the destruction caused by these two hurricanes impact or affect people's views on politics in terms of the debate, the long-standing debate in Puerto Rico about commonwealth or statehood or independence?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's going to have a significant effect regarding public opinion on the federal government itself, on its efficiency or lack thereof. And hopefully this will eventually lead to discussions and conversations on Puerto Rico's political status. Because for the past 18 days, we, the people of Puerto Rico, have been taking whatever matters possible into our own hands. Communities, this involving our diaspora, have been at the heart of Puerto Rico's recovery. So disaster relief, aid, provisions, and groundwork have taken place at a micro community level with local efforts such as neighborhood brigades and watches, efforts to keep the community informed by local AM radio stations. So once we register and internalize this amazing feat we've taken on alone, which is our survival, I think the possibility of a discussion on autonomy and hopefully on sovereignty and independence will arise and maybe become action. So I think this is an opportunity to push that political status conversation regarding independence and sovereignty.
That was Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer. Find a link to her recent article titled Irma and Maria, Shedding Light on Puerto Rico's Colonial Reality and Related Reports by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This year has seen dozens of cities in four states recognize the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day, replacing the nation's Columbus Day holiday. Columbus is being exposed more widely as a person undeserving of honor for his personal behavior toward the Indigenous peoples he encountered and for his larger role in the genocide of millions of people native to the Americas. This year has also seen more defacing of Columbus statues around the country. Bucking those trends, the town of Southington, Connecticut, unveiled a brand new bust of Columbus on October 9th, honoring him for, quote, discovering America. The statue was promoted and funded by Italian-American groups and the Knights of Columbus, a conservative Catholic organization. The town council of Southington voted unanimously to install the Columbus bust on public property, in a prominent location in front of a municipal building. Dozens of people, mostly women, protested silently at the dedication ceremony, holding signs with quotes from Columbus's own diaries, revealing his racist, misogynist, and genocidal tendencies. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and spoke with Erica Rogoveen Byrne, co-founder of the group Southington Women for Progress, which led the opposition to locating the statue on public property. We also hear from Susan Dantino, a local Italian-American woman who came to protest the dedication of the Columbus Monument.
When we found out in July that the town council had approved and that a statue of Columbus was being put up on public property...
Unanimous,
and with very limited public input. We frankly were kind of shocked that that was going to be happening in 2017, especially given what we now know about Columbus and his actions and how they've impacted Indigenous people and African Americans through the slave trade. And so we first began with a petition asking that the statue not be put up on town land, that they started putting up the statue before we could present the petition to the town council. And so we've been working since then to try to mitigate some of the harm that can be done by putting the statue up of Columbus on public property.
It does seem a little anachronistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many other places are putting up statues of Columbus in 2017, mm-hmm. but people know what they want to know, I guess, and I guess the word hasn't spread.
Yes, we definitely, there was a quote from a town council person in the newspaper saying, well, what we learned in school was that Columbus discovered America, and so that's what we learned. And it's like, yeah, but we keep learning, and we learn new information, and we also learn more about how it impacted people, and that maybe we didn't know that piece of it before.
So now the statue is here. I'm looking at it. It's got a little walkway. It's got lovely roses planted all around it, mm-hmm. American flags. And it looks pretty permanent. Mm-hmm. So what is your group's plan or hope for going forward?
What we're hoping is that we can either have the plaque on the statue itself corrected. The plaque says, or the inscription says, that Columbus discovered America on the inscription, which is historically inaccurate. We're also hoping that we can put together a committee of people to talk about putting a freestanding plaque up nearby that talks more about the complicated historical context of Columbus. We had hoped to come to some kind of agreement with the organizers, the committee that had put the statue together in the first place, but they declined to work with us on it. We also had requested to be able to participate in the dedication ceremony to present a fuller picture of Columbus, and they also denied that request. So that led to us participating here today. It is interesting that now we are kind of in this false equivalence world where we feel compelled to balance everything out, or that we're not telling the full story. I mean, he was an explorer. He came to the Caribbean. He certainly, to some degree, opened up the Caribbean and the Americas to exploration, though others probably would have done that if he hadn't. But the impact, the historical legacy of Columbus is, if you just read his own words in his journals, is just so horrific in a lot of ways. I mean, he bragged about being able to subjugate the natives that he encountered. He said, they shall be good and intelligent servants. He talked about the price that he could get for women and children sold into slavery. And these were his own words.
That was Erica Roggeveen Byrne, co-founder of Southington Women for Progress. Italian-American Southington resident Susan Dantino was also there. She said her opposition was not an attack on people of Italian heritage who revere Columbus as one of them.
I believe that this is a national conversation that we need to be having. I believe that this is something that we all need to be participating in. And while we want to protect culture, we also want to protect the truth. And I believe that by his own admission, Columbus was participated in and led the annihilation of over 3 million indigenous people. And we believe that, this is revisionist history. I'm a grandmother. I don't want my grandchildren learning lies. I want them to know the truth. And we really do support the truth. I believe, again, this is a national conversation that needs to happen, that we don't celebrate those people who, by their own admission, commit atrocities. If you want to erect a statue, then put it in a museum where it can be put into its historical context. I work with an organization for indigenous people for over, 15 years now. If I did not come out here today, I would really question those 15 years that I spent with an organization that supports our native people. That's Hawkwind. And we've done a lot of good in bringing to light the many atrocities suffered by our indigenous people. So I believe that that's the reason I'm here today.
That was Susan Dantino and Erica Ruggeveen Byrne, opponents of a newly dedicated Columbus Monument in Southington, Connecticut. For more information on groups opposing the honoring of Columbus across the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The deadliest so far. The sounds of gunfire crackle through the night air, but few seem to realize its import. Some think it's firecrackers. Some, the thump, thump, thump of helicopter blades chopping through the air. Some even think it's sound effects to accentuate tones of a country western band. Then the music stops and people fall, their bodies awash in crimson. And slowly, as in a dream or a real-life horror show, comes the realization. And screams rip through the air, grim accompaniment to the sound of automatic weapons fire. A new city joins the carnage that is uniquely American. In the space of 15 minutes, dozens are dead and over 500,000 wounded. A new record, a uniquely American one, is Las Vegas, Nevada, America's deadliest mass shooting. Politicians and cops hurl curses at a corpse. A man once, yes, but now a number. For he is now the last victim of his own hand. Politicians have never seemed so helpless than at times like these. Politicians, the most powerful people and powerful systems, offer prayers for the dead and little else. Why are they so helpless? Because they've sold their souls to the gun lobby, and because the killer killed himself, he is now beyond threats of prison or death sentences. They will bow their heads, pray, and even order flags flown low, and little else. For like the killings of children in 2012, or the slaughter of dancers at The Pulse, that nightclub in Orlando a year ago, they have nothing but prayers to offer. As we witness the deadliest mass shooting in American history, that is, until the next time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Natives of the island. Columbus docked in November 1493, and with him came the force and greed of the Spanish Empire. For four centuries, Spain brought imperial exploitation, slavery, repression, and death to the Arawaks, and in its place arose a new people, the mixture of Southern Europe, Spain, the remnants of Indians and Africans. After the U.S. pushed a weakened Spain out of Cuba, it seized Puerto Rico as well. From that seizure of 1898 by the U.S. until today, Puerto Rico has been an American property under the U.S. government's thumb. Did you know that Puerto Ricans can't vote for president? That they on the island can't vote in general elections? They fight in every American war and die in every conflict. When U.S. businesses open up shop in PR, they are exempt from taxes, money that could aid the island in its health and educational needs. And just days ago, after being lashed by nature's fury as Hurricane Maria, when they dared complain about slow American response, the moronic U.S. president called Puerto Ricans ingrates. Ingrates. Now, weeks later, they are still suffering. No water, no food, no power. They are Americans in name, but in fact, they are colonial subjects of the U.S. Empire, used by America, and then forgotten. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. In 1992, the brilliant law professor Derrick Bell published Faces at the Bottom of the Well, a series of potent essays on the sustained efforts of America to assign the bottom of the well to dark Americans for generations. Prison Radio presents Voices from the Bottom of the Well. Denizens of Death Row, People in Solitary, Juvenile Lifers, Jailhouse Environmentalists, and, yes, political prisoners have been among those voices who, by speaking out, have brought needed light to the darkest corners of American life. Thank you for helping to bring that light by supporting Prison Radio. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Was the election last July of a constituent assembly in Venezuela illegitimate and unconstitutional? Who is behind the protests in opposition to the Maduro government? Why did the government of Hugo Chavez fail to address corruption, social violence, and other factors when it took power in the early 2000s? How critical a factor have U.S. agencies and foreign policy played in jeopardizing Venezuela's political and economic prospects? Why is the Canadian government leveling sanctions against the Maduro government, and what tangible impacts are they likely to have? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we revisit Venezuela on the eve of state elections and at a volatile moment in the history of the Bolivarian Revolution. Over the course of the next 60 minutes, we will hear from Caracas-based journalist Lucas Kerner on recent developments. We'll hear background from Professor of Comparative Politics and Venezuela expert Julia Buxton. And we'll get some thoughts about Canada's recent sanctioning of the South American state from University of Manitoba professor and solidarity activist Henry Heller. On this week's program, Venezuela in the Crosshairs. Are we witnessing a slow-motion coup d'etat? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 13th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In one of its recent initiatives, the Justice Department, or DOJ, appears to be attacking the First Amendment as part of the apparent bipartisan program to make Vladimir Putin the fall guy for everything that goes wrong in Washington. In the past month, the DOJ has revealed that the FBI is investigating Russian-owned news outlets, Sputnik News and RT International, and has sent letters to the latter demanding that one of its business affiliates register as a foreign agent by October 17th. The apparent line of inquiry that the Bureau is pursuing is that both are agencies of the Russian government and that both have been spreading disinformation that is intended to discredit the United States government and its institutions. This alleged action would make them, in the DOJ view, a propaganda arm of a foreign government rather than a news service. It also makes them subject to Department of the Treasury oversight under the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938. That comes from the article, Sputnik and Russia Today, Under Investigation by U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, by Philip Giraldi, posted October 11th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. The United States military has dropped a total of 751 bombs on Afghanistan in September, the highest monthly number in the past 7 years, according to data by the U.S. Air Force's Central Command. The figure indicated a 50% increase from August, 503 bombs, which the command attributed to President Donald Trump's so-called strategy to more proactively target extremist groups in the country. Since 2010, the highest number of bombs dropped on Afghanistan by the U.S. military was 589 in August 2012, still over 150 less than September 2017. The U.S. has dropped a total 3,238 bombs in Afghanistan between January and September this year, more than two times the 1,337 dropped the year before. This increase can be attributed to the president's strategy to more proactively target extremist groups that threaten the stability and security of the Afghan people, the report said. That comes from the article, U.S. military dropped 751 bombs in Afghanistan in September, posted October 10th, originally appearing at Press TV. Officials with the Federation Council Commission for the Protection of State Sovereignty concluded during a meeting on Monday that attempts to interfere in Russia's internal affairs were noticeable during the regional elections in September of this year, even though they did not show much influence on the outcome of the elections. It is worthy of note that the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe came to conclusion that Russia improperly executes the verdict of the European Court of Human Rights on the case of embezzlement at Kirovly's company. The committee left the case under control, and Russian senators found the decision of European officials, quote, an attempt on the Russian electoral sovereignty, unquote. According to the Council of the Federation, departments of the Council of Europe may make biased political decisions. Thus, the ECHR and other structures of the Council of Europe are dominated by representatives of the countries that imposed sanctions against Russia. That comes from the article, The Kremlin's U.S. Gate Probe. Russia gets ready for U.S. interference in 2018 presidential election, by Anton Kulikov, posted October 11th, originally appearing at Pravda Report. Former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff warned Sunday that Washington's interference in Venezuela is, quote-unquote, extremely dangerous and could provoke an armed conflict. Quote, our continent has been living in peace for 140 years. Any attempt to interfere in the legitimate constitutional process in Venezuela, including by forcing a presidential election, is extremely dangerous, as it might lead to a civil war, unquote, she said in an exclusive interview with RT in Moscow. Rousseff was herself impeached and removed from her elected post last year in what was widely decried as a parliamentary coup. The Brazilian leader likewise took aim at her Congress-designated successor, Michel Temer, who has moved to align Brasilia's foreign policy closely with Washington, leading the regional charge against the government in Caracas. That comes from the article, Ousted Brazilian President, U.S. Intervention in Venezuela Could Spark Civil War, by Lucas Kerner, posted October 10th, originally appearing at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. An aggressive Turkish move could now try to cut off the Kurdish Afrin area from the Syrian government-held areas by connecting the Turkish-controlled rebel area in the north with the Al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib governorate. Such a move would encounter fierce resistance not only from Kurdish elements and the Syrian government, but also from Iran. Auxiliary Iranian troops hold the government corridor between Aleppo and Afrin to protect some important Shia villages in the area. On one side, one can understand the Turkish abrogation of its duties under the Astana Agreement. Erdogan is afraid of the domestic backlash a real fight against HTS would likely cause. That comes from the article, Syria. Turkey violates Astana Agreement, renews alliance with Al-Qaeda. Posted October 10th, originally appearing at Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Maduro government has been facing a crisis of legitimacy, at least in the eyes of the international press. Last July, the government held an election for a constituent assembly which would be empowered to rewrite the constitution in 9 critical areas. Critics within the U.S., Canada, and other allied powers have attempted to portray this action as an anti-democratic power grab by President Maduro. Meanwhile, over 120 people in Venezuela have died since April in connection with opposition protests and reprisals by Venezuelan security forces. And as this broadcast goes to air, Venezuela is in the run-up to regional elections, which will choose state governors with 4-year mandates. To assess whether depictions of Maduro as a dictator have merit and what is behind the protests gaining world attention in recent months, we're joined by Lucas Kerner. He's a Caracas-based writer who has been following on-the-ground activities in Venezuela and contributes to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles frequently appear at globalresearch.ca. So, Lucas, how's it going?
Great to be here, Michael.
Well, thanks for joining us. Now, could we try to provide some context for the Constituent Assembly that was voted in a couple of months ago. It's being portrayed as anti-democratic. What do you have to say share with our listeners about this? The constitutionality and legitimacy of the Constitutional Assembly.
Yeah, I want to begin with the context in May in which it was called, in which basically you had, 2 months at that time of what, have been depicted throughout the international media as peaceful, nonviolent protests against an authoritarian regime, but in reality for the mass majority of the population living here was, in fact, a violent right-wing insurgency that was bent on overthrowing the government, demanding early presidential elections, even though presidential elections are not scheduled until 2018, and was, using, extremely violent tactics such as, burning barricades in the middle of streets and actually shooting at people who attempted to remove them or causing traffic accidents or, actually just political assassinations in a number of cases. And this was, the context in which, on May 1st, President Maduro invoked the Venezuela's constitution, which has a provision to convoke a constituent assembly to redraft the constitution. And basically, this was his bid to find a solution to the existing political impasse that's, been, Venezuela has been in the midst and the grips of an economic and increasingly political crisis for the last 3 years. And this was a bid to basically, refound the country to, rewrite the social contract, ensure a new foundation of legitimacy, to go forward. And, in that sense, also to defeat this right-wing insurgency that was seeking to overthrow the government. So in this sense, Venezuela's constitution, unlike, the United States constitution, for example, which, one could argue is absolutely legitimate because it was never, approved through any popular vote or any, it was actually, approved by a group of, merchants and slave owners, after the Articles of Confederation was, it dissolved arguably, illegally. That the Venezuela's constitution was actually approved in 1999 by a popular referendum, so it has more legitimacy than most constitutions in the world. And in that constitution, unlike the United States and most countries of the global north, their constitutions, it has a provision that citizens can convoke an assembly to redraft a constitution. It actually provides provisions for its own dissolution and redrafting, and that's an incredibly progressive measure because, if we had the United States, we could actually push for, extremely significant progressive reforms that are barred by the framework of that constitution. So Maduro called this on May 1st, and throughout the country, anyone could basically collect a certain number of signatures to sign up. The opposition seeking to overthrow the government boycotted this process, as did the largest business federation of Chamber of Commerce, FedeCommerce, and basically, you had 16,000 candidates, and because the opposition boycotted it, you had an interesting situation in which this July 30th election pitted, the candidates who were backed by the PSU, by the ruling Socialist Party, by the bureaucracy, by the government, but you also had a lot of grassroots social movement candidates who were running against them. So you had this extremely, I would say, rich dialectical interplay between these, different proposals and the space and, for, internal, contestation and critique that you would not have had otherwise. And this, this itself explains the 8 million people, over 8.2 million people who came out to vote on July 30th, despite, and amid this, what can only really be described as a campaign of terror on the part of the opposition in which they attacked. They besieged 200 voting centers throughout the country. A candidate, in Bolivar State to the Ibadi was assassinated the night beforehand. You had a bomb went off in the wealthy eastern Caracas the day of the event. It looked like something out of Syria. So it was clearly, an extremely tense situation. But it was a triumph. Undoubtedly a political triumph for the Bolivarian Revolution, that, right after this election, which, as we recall, countries throughout the world led by Trump, were threatening, economic sanctions, all kinds of, basically total political, economic excommunication against Venezuela, for holding this vote, that they held it, and immediately these, violent insurrectionary mobilizations led by the right wing stopped. immediately and afterwards. And that was a, you know, absolutely phenomenal development. And this, you know, explains in many ways the Maduro's bump in popularity that, you know, he was able to achieve this. So I think that in terms of that, you know, in referring to your question about, you know, the constitutional legitimacy, I mean, it's clearly written in Venezuela's constitution that the president, you know, like the National Assembly, like the people can, you know, like the population can convoke this body. So there's no doubt about that. There was a particular constitutional gripe with the Attorney General with whether this can be done without a triggering referendum, but the constitution does not specify that, so it's more of a question of strict versus loose reading of the constitution. But in any case, the countries that have, you know, boycotted the, you know, this assembly, who are, you know, basically threatened the country with and have enacted sanctions against Venezuela, like the United States and Canada, you know, are in no position to offer an interpretation of Venezuela's constitution. So it's a pretty ridiculous argument from their part.
This is a very different conception of democracy from what we're used to in Canada and the United States, where democracy is basically you vote every 4 years and then, you know, do whatever in the interim. But here you have an instance where people are participating in making decisions between elections of, you know, your duly elected representatives. But you're maintaining that. I should also add that, I mean, this is coming from one of our parliamentarians. Interestingly enough, the foreign affairs critic for the left of center progressive NDP, saying that. That you're basically calling the vote for the Constituency Assembly illegitimate, and saying it's more important than ever for Canada to work with our allies and through multilateral groups like the OAS, to the Organization of American States, to secure a lasting resolution to the crisis in Venezuela. So, what are your thoughts about these sorts of statements from people in the supposedly democratic West?
Yeah, just before I get into that, I just wanted to respond to your point about this new conception of democracy, that Article 347 of the Venezuelan Constitution clearly states the original constituent power rests with the people of Venezuela. This power may be exercised by calling on a National Constituent Assembly for the purpose of transforming the state, creating a new juridical order, and drawing up a new constitution. So this is a radically, you know, different perspective of democracy, as you say. I think in terms of Canada, the response from Canada, I mean, I think that it's not very surprising at all, given what we saw Canada's key role alongside the United States in conspiring, you know, with OAS Secretary General Luis Almagro against Venezuela earlier this year. I mean, we saw in April that these powers carried out a coup. With Venezuela and Bolivia denounced a coup within the OAS, in which Bolivia was set to exercise the presidency, the pro tempore presidency of the permanent council, and it had effectively nullified, right? It had took off the agenda a meeting to discuss Venezuela, citing that there was no reason to have a meeting without Venezuela's permission. And basically, these powers got together and they installed Honduras's representative as the president, and they convoked this session in which they sought to pass this resolution of Venezuela, which they still couldn't pass. So, I mean, Canada has been constantly pushing within the OAS for the application of the democratic charter against Venezuela, which would effectively suspend it from the body and open it up to all kinds of regional sanctions. So there's no doubt about Canada's role there.
I was wondering if you could talk about some of the opposition demonstrations that we've been seeing. What we're hearing, again, from Canadian and American politicians and others is that they're being spurred on by a humanitarian crisis that's, you know, linked to shortages of food and medicine. And so there's, you know, desperate attempts to call for Maduro to step down. What can you tell us about who the opposition is?
Well, I think it's important to recognize from the get-go that the leaders of the misnamed Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is the main right-wing opposition coalition, all of these leaders, Henrique Capriles, the current governor of Miranda, Leopoldo López, who has been convicted of leading the last round of violent insurrectionary protests in 2014, Julio Borges, the president of the National Assembly, all of these people were involved and played, you know, leading roles in the 2002 coup that ousted then-President Hugo Chavez for 47 hours. In fact, Henrique Capriles and Leopoldo López actually engaged in the kidnapping of the interior minister at the time. None of these people faced any jail time. None of these people, in fact, Chavez issued an amnesty for all these, which probably was an error on his part. But nonetheless, I mean, these people have zero democratic credentials. Let's also remember that this coup was blessed by the Bush administration, by the Aznar administration in Madrid, by the New York Times. So, I mean, it's very, you know, hypocritical for these people to, you know, to be speaking about democracy ever, given that, you know, in that moment, in fact, it's very hypocritical for them to be defending the current constitution, which they claim to be doing against the National Constituent Assembly, when these people, the Carmona decree, the dictatorship that came to power for those 47 hours, passed a decree that tore up the Constitution, dissolved the National Assembly, dissolved all the other existing branches of government. That, you know, clearly, you know, the most undemocratic, you know, maneuver imaginable. So, I mean, this is the context we have to understand to see, you know, what's going on here. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the situation, I mean, I think that, you know, Venezuela is going through a very severe economic crisis. And, you know, there are shortages of medicine, so that there is a very, you know, difficult situation there. You know, a lot of it, you know, definitely can be attributed to, you know, the mismanagement on the part of the government, particularly in the era of the oil bonanza and everything, corruption. But there's also just, you know, a reality of economic strangulation. There's always been an economic war against Venezuela, and we can go into that. But I mean, the key point is that these protests were not about that. I mean, their key demands were, you know, basically for the ouster of President Maduro, for early presidential elections, you know, despite them not being, you know, scheduled until next year. So, that, I mean, that's not really a constitutional, you know, legitimate demand in any way. And I think that we have to take this on top of the fact that, you know, the Venezuela's opposition, you know, despite all these claims of dictatorship, Venezuela's opposition actually won the December 6th, 2015 parliamentary elections, and with a majority. And yet, what did they do with that majority? Absolutely nothing. They attempted to oust the government. The new incoming head of the parliament at that time, Henry Ramos Ayu, he declared, you know, the objective of this new parliament to oust Maduro within 6 months, quote unquote. And of course, this was, you know, this is unconstitutional because a, you know, recall referendum, which Venezuela actually has, you know, provisions for, would take, you know, 8 months. So this gives you an idea of, you know, and the laws that they passed were, you know, all, you know, struck down by the Supreme Court because they were evidently unconstitutional, like an amnesty law that would have basically ripped out, you know, large numbers of pages from the criminal code and, you know, released, you know, opposition militants who are, you know, convicted or are facing charges for, you know, violent acts. As it's specified, you know, I read the law of, you know, military rebellion, you know, assault, homicide, even drug trafficking, all kinds of things like that. So it's clearly, you know, or the, you know, there's, I can go on, there's a whole number of, you know, but basically they, when they had the opportunity to legislate and govern, they made no effort to actually, in fact, they were, the parliament didn't convene 24 times due to lack of quorum because their legislators didn't show up, which evidences that they were not ever interested in governing. They were always interested in overthrowing the government as quickly as possible with the backing of the United States so they can implement their neoliberal shock therapy program. So that's always been the case.
What about the people on the ground? I'm wondering if, because I think it's very important to point out that there have been demonstrations both against the government and for the Maduro government. So I'm wondering if you could maybe compare and contrast those two different kinds of demonstrations, both in terms of numbers and in terms of tactics.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we saw on April 19th, it was a massive massive pro and anti-government demonstrations. Only the anti-government demonstrations got coverage in the international media, of course. I mean, and it was massive. There was hundreds of thousands of people there. But the government side was equally massive. And, you know, with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people marching to support the government. This was similarly, the Chavista masses also came out to support the government on May Day. And, you know, there have been continual marches since then. I mean, it was a likewise, when the opposition held on July 16th what it called a plebiscite, which although Venezuela's constitution has no provision for a plebiscite, you know, this is the supposed defenders of Venezuela's constitution, they held this plebiscite on asking their, you know, supporters if they wanted to have a National Constituent Assembly, basically asking their supporters if they wanted to have a military coup, in so many words, and if they wanted to set up a parallel government. And on the same day, the Chavista government, the National Electoral Council, held a dry run for the National Constituent Assembly elections for July 30th, which you had, you know, something like 2 million people come out for that, you know, dry run. So it was clear, and this was, of course, completely blocked out of the international media coverage, that you had this, you know, parallel show of support for the government. And likewise, you know, I think the key instance is the over 8 million people who came out to support the National Constituent Assembly on July 30th, just, you know, made crossing rivers in Tashira State, you know, in many instances. You know, you had 100-year woman being carried up the steps to vote. That, I mean, these are, you know, of course, the international media doesn't report any of these things. And, you know, in fact, attempts to, you know, delegitimize this, claiming fraud, even though the opposition has cried fraud for, you know, basically every single you know, election except for the ones that they win, coincidentally. The key point is that, you know, this vote, this 8 million vote on July 30th was not so much an endorsement of the government as it was a rejection of the opposition violence, this terroristic violence. Likewise, it was a rejection of this economic sabotage, and, you know, it was clearly being pushed forward by the opposition. There has been mass mobilization in the streets over this past year, not necessarily totally in support of the government, but definitely, you know, in rejection of this, you know, insurrection, you know, this violent insurrectionary campaign on the part of the opposition, as well as, you know, the economic conditions that, you know, in many ways have been exacerbated, you know, intentionally by the United States and, you know, by the opposition itself.
I'm wondering what the sense is on the ground. Are we witnessing a coup in slow motion? I mean, perhaps comparable to what happened in 2002, and then there was the counter coup that overthrew that. I mean, are we looking at something along those lines, or perhaps even something more severe? What are the thoughts where you are?
I think that the key moment of danger in which, you know, there was real concern about the government being overthrown, well, you know, I think we're past that for now. I mean, that was, you know, during these, you know, this violent right-wing insurgency and these protests. But I think that, you know, the reality is that since, you know, Chavez's, you know, strategy to reform and transform the armed forces, and, you know, the fact is, you, right now, you have an arm, unlike in Chile in 1973, you have a armed forces that is loyal to the existing constitutional order and is not going to engage in any coup. And without that, the opposition is incapable of overthrowing the government in the short term. And I think the opposition's willingness to quickly, to right after, you know, these National Constituent Assembly elections, to announce that it's willing to participate in the this regional elections we're going to see here on Sunday. So I think that we're, you know, the possibility of a, you know, violent overthrow of the government is not in the cards right now. I mean, I think that the key question right now is the, you know, it's the, if we're not in a moment, a war of movement, as Gramsci would say, we're definitely, you know, the war position, you know, continues, in the sense the opposition is attempting to use these, you know, trying to gain a victory, a massive victory in the regional elections, which could, you know, discredit the government, which they're calling it a referendum on the government, a referendum on the National Constituent Assembly. Likewise, the government is calling, you know, likewise, you know, trying to play it up, you know, possible victory as a consolidation of its legitimacy and legitimacy of the National Constituent Assembly. So this is what is at stake, and, you know, it's really I think both sides are measuring their forces in the lead up to next year's presidential elections. So we'll see what will happen on Sunday to see, well, you know, can the United Socialist Party of Venezuela mobilize enough of its supporters, you know, in order to, you know, defend, hold the line against this right-wing, you know, international and domestic onslaught, or is the opposition going to be able to accumulate more forces and, you know, possibly push towards a victory in presidential elections next year?
Very much appreciate your insights, Lucas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
We've been speaking with Lucas Kerner. He is a Caracas-based writer and contributor to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles also appear regularly at globalresearch.ca. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Julia Buxton is a professor of comparative politics at the Central European University's School of Public Policy and senior research associate at the Global Drug Policy Observatory at Swansea University. Buxton is a specialist on Latin America and an expert on Venezuela, receiving her PhD from the London School of Economics, where she also studied for her MA with distinction in comparative politics. Buxton spoke at a late September conference at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, put on by that institution's Geopolitical Economy Research Group. The focus of the talk was Venezuela, was another world possible? I had a chance to gauge her thoughts about some of the recent history of Venezuela and the dynamics currently shaping developments there.
To what extent has the rise of Chavez and his program been dependent on his personal appeal versus pre-existing dynamics within the society that's made his rise more or less a symptom? Could you address
that? No, absolutely. I think that's a very helpful observation. And what Chavez managed to canalize, to channel, was profound problems of economic exclusion, economic marginalization. Even though Venezuela is a very mixed and a very interracial society, it was also culturally a very white society. It was very much defined by its relationship with the United States. It had what was perceived as a Yankee culture, very baseball-oriented, and governed by a very traditional white political class. So you did have high levels of exclusion and high levels of political alienation, but the problem was that that couldn't really be channeled through the political system at the time. There was a lot of electoral fraud. There was a lot of repression, particularly of trade union movements that weren't affiliated to the old state system. So Chavez indeed, I think, brought together grassroots organizations, disaffected sections within the military, a whole range of different outside popular grassroots interests and organizations, and really brought them into a ruling coalition which sought to address the inequality and exclusion that had characterized the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been improvements, or there were considerable improvements under Chavez in the early period, addressing the ethnic and racial disparities, the economic program and distribution. But then there were some things that were not addressed, the corruption, social violence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why that was. Was it simply a matter of priorities, or was there blind spots? How do you account for these?
Well, Chavez inherited serious problems of corruption. He inherited a very politicized state, and he inherited a very serious problem of crime, lawlessness, and, you know, very, very serious homicide rates. And I think the problem was that in the early 2000s, certainly after 2002, when there was the failed coup attempt against Chavez, Chavez turned to really trying to build up his support, consolidate support amongst the popular sectors. And that was addressed really through the redistribution of the oil export revenues through immense programs, which did, at the time, seriously address the inequalities and exclusion of Venezuelan society. But the problem was that these issues of corruption were actually deepened. The state became more proactive in the economy through a series of expropriations and nationalizations. Rather than necessarily deconstructing the old corrupt state he inherited, Chavez, in effect, built a parallel institutional framework through the misiones, the social policy initiatives. And all the time, key aspects such as violent crime continued to increase. And what we saw were efforts to address homicide and insecurity in Venezuela. But the problem was there was just such a high level of ministerial turnover. So in the Interior Ministry and the Justice Ministries, things like pretrial detention, the failures of the penal system, simply weren't addressed because nobody was in power long enough in these ministries to actually carry through a coherent program. We had something like 13 different ministers of the Interior during the 15 years of the Chavez presidency. So there kind of became a bit of an institutional inertia, which it was possible to gloss over with the oil revenues to an extent. But when the oil revenues fell, these problems came back far more serious than they've been before.
Could you comment on some of the influences from external factors, particularly the United States, the CIA, National Endowment for Democracy type interference in the society? I mean, what forms did they take, and how did their influence change from the early years, Chavez's early period, to going up to today?
Well, where we are today now with Chavez's successor after Chavez's death in 2013 with Nicolas Maduro is that Venezuela is in an acutely difficult situation. It's facing sanctions from the United States. There's a travel ban. There are also obstacles to dealing in Venezuelan sovereign debt, which the U.S. has now imposed. And so the whole series of measures, decertification for non-compliance, alleged non-compliance in the war of drugs. And what we see really is that the Trump administration is following a pattern of continuity that we saw under President Obama, we saw under President Bush, and which actually started way back in 1997 with Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who actually refused to meet President Chavez before he was elected to the presidency. There was a view that Chavez really would be disruptive of the very strong bilateral ties that Venezuela and the U.S. had traditionally had. Venezuela had always been a strategically important supplier of oil exports to the United States. So what we've seen is the U.S. intervene in Venezuela in various different ways and through different mechanisms and institutions, none of which have actually succeeded in toppling the regime and which have probably, in my assessment, served to actually prevent the anti-Chavista opposition movement from building popular support. Because the big problem is when you're receiving money from institutions such as the National Endowment for Democracy and the NDI and USAID, as the Venezuelan opposition has done, then the challenge becomes that the opposition didn't do the normal, very challenging, very tiresome hard work of going into the barrios and going into communities and rebuilding support, because instead they were looking to Washington, to the US, which were is their primary funder. So we've had efforts to support the opposition through financial resources, through military support, and also through actions in international bodies such as the United Nations, condemning Venezuela, by the US, led by the US, and US-led institutions such as Human Rights Watch and other NGOs, which have also taken a very critical stance on Venezuela from a very, very early phase when arguably all Chavez represented was moderate social democracy. And I would argue very strongly, and I have done in my writing, that US actions actually pushed Chavez further and further to the left. So the U.S. has created a serious situation in Venezuela, which it continues to deepen every day.
Mm. And I'm wondering about some of the influences of the Venezuela's project on other countries in South America, the kinds of impacts that they're having, for better or for worse, and whether U.S. strategy is geared at trying to create divisions between Venezuela and other countries.
It's certainly the case that the United States, through successive administrations, has sought to insulate the influence of Venezuela. During the period of the Bush administration, there was a view that Venezuela represented what they called part of an axis of evil, threatening U.S. interests in the region, but also threatening democracy and human rights in Latin America itself. Chavez benefited greatly, and his initial leverage was made possible because of a wider pink revolution, pink tide, as it was called, across the region. We had left-of-center candidates elected in Bolivia, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, Nicaragua. So Venezuela was really seen to be kind of at the leadership, at the helm of these wider leftward shifts. But the reality is that Venezuela and the election of Chavez was really very much influenced by Venezuela-specific variables. We had writers and academics at the time who tried to say that there was a good left and a bad left, and Venezuela represented a very, very bad left, so there was kind of levels of tolerance for a democratic leftism in Latin America, but not Chavez's type. And then certainly there was an effort to also isolate Venezuela and Cuba, and that changed very significantly under President Obama, who reached out to Cuba to an extent. But then what we've seen under President Trump is that those efforts to kind of divide and rule, which I think was Obama's strategy, separating Venezuela and Cuba, two very close allies, Trump has now turned that on his head, and in moving away from any form of U.S. rapprochement with Cuba, has driven Venezuela and Cuba back closer together again.
Now, there's also, of course, the issue you mentioned earlier about the nationalization of the oil, and we've seen oil prices go down. And I'm wondering if you could point to just how significant a factor that has been to some of the difficulties that Venezuela is currently experiencing and some of the instability that we're seeing play out currently.
Absolutely. Well, Venezuela has a history of boom-bust economic performance. This is something that goes right back to the beginnings of oil exploration and exploitation in the country in the 1920s. What's particularly salient in terms of what happened under President Chavez is Chavez came to power committed to diversifying Venezuela's reliance on oil export revenues. 96% of export revenues come from oil. But what happened during this kind of period in the early 2000s is that oil dependence actually deepened. Strategies for diversification of the economy really began to run aground. And particularly after 2006, when he was elected for a third time, Chavez emphasized that oil would become the motor of the economy. So actually, rather than diversifying, Venezuela should make better advantage from its oil resources. And it worked very closely with OPEC. It's ended quota busting, worked very closely with other hawks such as Iran to try and keep the oil price high. But the problem has been, obviously, that the oil price has collapsed, and so that's left Venezuela very vulnerable. It's been devastating in terms of the economic resources. When you've moved from oil price per barrels of $120 per barrel down to around $30-$35, the implications of that for the national budget have been absolutely immense. But more problematic also is that all of Venezuela's refining capacity, essentially, is in the United States. And Venezuela never addressed those contradictions in its energy policy.
What about the unaddressed the issues of corruption and social violence that you mentioned earlier were inherited? Are we seeing that eating away at the current government? It's certainly being used in a lot of Western criticism, but I'm wondering to what extent that is. Those unaddressed problems have just grown and are starting to have an impact. I mean, how significant is it on top of the oil and other factors?
I'd say it's hugely, hugely salient. So you have a collapse in the oil price, so the government's capacity to maintain its redistribution programs has essentially evaporated. According to the United Nations, Venezuela has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. Now, if you want to build a participatory democracy and you want people to be out and about and engaged and deliberating, and yet it's too dangerous and violent to go out after dark, that really limits your capacity to have an engaged community. And the problem is that this violence and crime really impacts the poorest communities, because the richest communities can pay for private security and then they can protect themselves in security-enforced homes. And the fact that it hasn't been addressed, deweaponization, taking so many of the guns out of Venezuelan society, it's actually been the reverse. The government has been quite willing to arm some of the groups that support it. And this is deeply, deeply problematic. And this rise in violence, I think, has really undercut the efforts to create a vibrant and active civil society, because the levels of fear and the danger are immense for Venezuela. As for the situation on corruption, this has really been exploited by Venezuela's critics. We need to see some proof for some of the more serious allegations that have been made and which have led to sanctions against individuals imposed by the United States. But it's certainly the case that there needs to be accountability for some of the immense amounts of money that came into the country during the oil boom, and which seem to have not really been accounted for through the government audit and budget procedures, which in terms themselves are also very opaque and very difficult to work through. And I do think that this has really seriously eroded, firstly, the idea that what Venezuela represents is progressive, but secondly, it's also led the Chavista movement to lose a whole swathe of social support. And what we have now in Venezuela is a society which is deeply polarized, but in which about 60-70% of the population neither support the government nor support the opposition, and that's a very dangerous situation to be in.
So what kinds of international alliances could Venezuela engage in to prop up their own aspirations for popular democracy?
Well, Venezuela has turned very much to countries such as China and to Russia, and particularly since the kind of ending of the Pink Tide and the re-election of right-wing political forces in Latin America, which has really led to the isolation, internal isolation of Venezuela within the region. It still relies on a lot of support from a number of Caribbean countries. These have been very influential in the OAS and blocking resolutions against Venezuela in the Organization of American States. Venezuela's always pursued the ideal of a multipolar world, so it's always looked to China and Russia to counterbalance the influence of the United States. But my very deep concern is that in looking in particular to China, what Venezuela has done has locked itself into a long-standing problem of commodity export dependence, except now that export market is not the United States, it's now China. And there is a very serious concern that Venezuela has effectively mortgaged its future to China because it's so indebted to China because of the huge amounts of loans that have come through from China. And in exchange, Venezuela is giving China oil reserves. And that's a very, very problematic long-term situation for Venezuela.
So that kind of leads me to my final question, which is the what-if question. You know, what could have been done differently to mitigate or prevent the economic and political situation so that they're not quite so beholden to China and some of the other issues that they're facing right now?
Okay. Well, the government maintains that they are facing a situation of economic warfare from its opponents. There is some level of credibility in that argument. But I'm afraid that my conclusion is that the government significantly have failed to adjust its economic policy. In 2002, when there was the coup attempt against Chavez, the government imposed price controls and exchange controls, and those have never been lifted. And what that has done over 15 years is to cause severe distortions in Venezuela's macro economy. We have staggering rates of inflation, and inflation hits the poorest sectors of society. It's also led to hoarding and people holding back food and supplies and not allowing those into the market. And we have an acute shortage of dollars in the country. Now, when you have a system of exchange controls, this has really become a kind of key platform for corruption. Those who are getting dollars at the official rate and then those who have to actually use the black market in order to obtain dollars. So the exchange rate system, the exchange controls have become really the key driver of the corruption. So I think the problems that Venezuela had could have been addressed through modestly adjusting economic policy, addressing these problems of inflation, lifting the exchange controls, despite the risks of capital flight that posed. There could have been adjustments made there. But most saliently, Venezuela has the cheapest subsidized oil in the world. And these oil subsidies, which essentially make oil cheaper than water, benefit the wealthiest sectors of Venezuelan society, those with the big cars. The poorest sectors usually rely on public transport. So in effect, by keeping oil, domestic petroleum, the cheapest, most subsidized fuel arguably in the world, you have created a very regressive system of income distribution. And that has not been addressed by the Venezuelan government over all of this time, I think, is indicative of the other failures.
Julia Buxton, I really appreciate your sharing these insights with our listeners.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Canadian government started to impose what they called the Special Economic Measures Act on September 22, 2017. Under this act, sanctions have been leveled against 40 Venezuelan officials and individuals who've, according to the Canadian government, have played a key role in undermining the security, stability, and integrity of democratic institutions in Venezuela. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, explained the move, saying, quote, "Canada will not stand by silently as the government of Venezuela robs its people of their fundamental democratic rights. Today's announcement of sanctions against the Maduro regime underscores our commitment to defending democracy and human rights around the world. Canada stands in solidarity with the people of Venezuela as they struggle to restore democracy in their country." Well, joining me right now is a professor of history at the University of Manitoba. His name is Henry Heller. He's also been very much involved in the solidarity work, and one of those actions includes an upcoming event on October 14th here in Winnipeg. So, Henry Heller, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm pleased to be here.
There's a lot of talk about human rights and democracy, but you got to remember this is the same Liberal government that approved of a $15 billion military procurement to Saudi Arabia. So I'm wondering, what do you think is behind this? Is it an authentic commitment to human rights and democracy, or is there some other motive behind the sanctions?
Well, I think that Canada is a country which has been pursuing a global strategy, which includes supporting NATO in Ukraine, and supporting directly and indirectly U.S. Occupations and invasions of Middle Eastern countries. It's involved in the occupation of Haiti alongside the United States under the mantle of the United Nations, but in fact against the will of the majority of Haitian people. And their approach to Venezuela has to be seen in this larger context. And Canada has had relations with Venezuela since the 50s. They exchanged ambassadors during the 50s. Venezuela was under dictatorship at that time, and the Canadian government didn't have any problem. Canada developed a significant economic relationship with Venezuela over the decades. The oil industry is very important. There are other sectors. There's a certain amount of Canadian investment in Venezuela.
Such as?
I think there are Canadian companies that are involved in various sectors. And from the beginning, that is to say, in 1998, when Chavez took power and brought to power a kind of populist government, the Canadian government has been resolutely opposed to Chavez because it threatens Canadian Western interests in Venezuela. The Canadian government, alongside the American government, has close ties to the upper bourgeoisie of Venezuela. And from the time that Chavez assumed the presidency, let's say in 98, until now, they have been supporting the overthrow, basically, of Chavez and then Maduro. And although, in fact, under Chavez and now under Maduro, the democratic process is actually deepening, that's exactly what they fear. And so so far as I know, for example, Canada has been through grants, through contacts. There is a ongoing information war going on within Venezuela, and the Canadian government has been using its expertise to support the opposition to Chavez and Maduro. So I would say that raising the question of democracy is false. It's just a falsehood. And Freeland is known as, you know, a fabricator. You know, she lacks credibility.
This does seem unusually unprecedented and hostile. Is that just a perception, or are we sort of entering a new phase in terms of Canada's involvement, engagement in Venezuela?
That's an interesting question. Well, they've been repressing the popular forces in Haiti more or less directly. I would say that you're right that the that certainly in the case of the Ukraine and Canadian involvement, military involvement, and also in Afghanistan, the counter-revolutionary nature of Canadian foreign policy is becoming more and more explicit. And certainly this act closely aligns itself with the growing aggressiveness of the United States vis-a-vis Venezuela. So they are becoming more overt, I would say. Maybe it's because they feel their grip is they're losing.
Do you have any idea or thoughts about the likely impacts of these sanctions? Are they going to have an impact on economically or in any other way?
I don't think that there will be an economic impact. It's political harassment. They're directed mainly at the current political elite, the ruling political elite in Venezuela, and I don't think that the Canadian government is not in a position to do very much damage to these people. So I don't think it's going to have an effect in that way. But it might have an effect on the Canadian situation in the sense that there are signs that they're becoming more restrictive in terms of the entry of Venezuelan government officials or professors or what have you into Canada, and that may affect the ability of the Canadian public to learn what the actual situation is in Venezuela. So I would say that that might be an effect.
Okay. Now, I understand that there is an event happening here in Winnipeg at Broadway Disciples United Church on October 14th in the evening.
Yes.
And you're helping to organize that, and you're also going to be speaking at the event. So I wonder if you want to just give our listeners, at least those in the Winnipeg area, a bit of a breakdown about what
It starts at 6:30, as you said, at the Broadway Disciples Church, and it's entitled Latin America Neoliberalism in Revolt, interspersed with entertainment, Latin American entertainment from some good Latino entertainers. There will be three talks. Francisco Venezuela will be talking about neoliberalism and its effects on a particular country as an example, Chile. Peter Kolchinsky of the Native Studies Department at the University of Manitoba will be talking about the effects of neoliberalism on the indigenous population, and I will be giving an overview, a sketch of the imposition of neoliberalism, which really dates from the 1970s, and its economic and political effects on the whole of the continent, and in particular stress is going to be on Venezuela. So we hope that this will be politically illuminating and also an entertaining event, and that people should come on down. And this is a free event, and I think they can meet interesting people and they'll hear some interesting perspectives.
Henry Heller, we really appreciate your thoughts. Thank you very much for sharing them with us here.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Henry Heller, a professor with the Department of History at the University of Manitoba.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks this week to University of Manitoba-based radio station CJUM 101.5 FM for the use of their recording facilities. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.